Take what's there, 'cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. This week in radical history for the week starting January 19th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website.
Check this out, man. There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history for January 19th, 1808, anarchist Lysander Spooner lives. Spooner set up a private postal service so successful that the federal government decided to outlaw it. Author of No Treason, The Constitution of No Authority, arguing the Constitution and the basic assumption of government is binding to no one. This book was described as possibly the most subversive document ever printed in this nation.
The city of Taos, New Mexico was awash with blood on this day in 1847. Just a year after being vacated by the Spanish and transferred to U.S. control, some of the Native Americans in the area were allied with the Mexican population there and had fought alongside them against the Spanish. To them, the land in question was both their ancestral home and part of Mexico. And so on this day, a group of Native Americans and Mexican nationals confronted the newly appointed governor of New Mexico, Charles Bent. An altercation erupted and Bent was killed, as were several of the Native Americans, who then went on a rampage targeting any white settlers they found. The conflict, which lasted for over a month and which took some 1,500 federal troops to suppress, was known as the Taos Uprising.
Also on January 19th, 1892 in Cuba, anarchists celebrate the first Cuban Regional Congress. The anarchists recommended the Cuban working class join the ranks of revolutionary socialism and take the path of independence. In a manifesto, they present a phrase which has passed into history. Quote, "It would be absurd for one who inspires individual freedom to oppose the collective freedom of the people." Spanish authorities would then suppress the Congress, close down the anarchist press, declare the alliance illegal, and deport or imprison the best-known anarchist participants. Also on January 19, 1915, world-famous labor organizer and songwriter Joe Hill is arrested in Salt Lake City, Utah. Joe Hill is convicted on trumped-up murder charges. His last words to his comrades was, "Don't mourn. Organize."
The U.S. Geological Survey reported on this day in 1920 that the United States' yet-to-be-extracted oil reserves would only be sufficient to meet the country's demands at the levels of that day for the next 20 years. The sizes of the known U.S. oil fields and the difficulty of extracting the oil using the methods that recurred at that time informed the survey's findings, and the agency warned that the U.S. would soon become dependent on oil from other countries if it did not develop alternative forms of energy generation. The agency's warning was correct, and although new oil fields had been discovered and extraction technologies have improved, the U.S. currently imports more than 60% of the oil it consumes and uses 26% of the world's energy output while having only 5% of the world's population and only 3% of the world's remaining oil reserves. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
People, the time's come.
This is your radio supporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, January 20th, in 1887, the Navy, with assistance from the U.S. Senate, leased Pearl Harbor in Hawaii as a naval base. Hawaii was still an independent kingdom and was just forced to adapt the Bayonet Constitution, a measure that stripped the king's powers and gave voting rights to Americans and European immigrants. Leasing Pearl Harbor secured American interests on the Hawaiian Islands and American dominance in the Pacific. In the 10 years that followed, the U.S. government overthrew the Hawaiian government, expanding Pearl Harbor into a state-of-the-art naval reservation, and increased the military force in other island nations, such as Cuba and the Philippines. Ah, U.S. imperialism at its finest. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
Also on January 20th, 1902, Army Brigadier General Jacob Smith asked the Marine Corps to assist them to help subdue the Filipino population on the island of Samar. Major Weller and his Marine Battalion were given the assignment. After a bunch of atrocities, Major Weller would be brought up on war criminal charges. Even though General Smith reported that, Weller said the following, quote, "I want no prisoners. I wish you to kill and burn. The more you kill and burn, the better it will please me. I want all prisoners killed who are capable of bearing arms in actual hostilities against the United States," unquote. anyone up to 10 years old. The Marines executed his orders. Despite the general's testimony, Major Weller would be acquitted of all charges and eventually retire as United States Marine Corps general himself. Also on January 20, 1929 in Manchuria, the Korean anarchist guerrilla general Kim Zhao-jin is assassinated while doing some repair work on a rice mill. The Korean Anarchist Federation in China was formed in April of 1924. Over 2 million Koreans were living in Manchuria, and the Korean anarchists were very active and influential among them. We are everywhere. Also on this date in 1960 in the Belgian Congo, Patrice Lumumba, first democratically elected president, is sentenced to 6 months on trumped-up charges, and the CIA has him murdered in 1961 by order of President Ike Eisenhower himself. He is shot, transported in a CIA car, and then his body is dumped in an acid bath. Also on this date in 1981, minutes after the inauguration of acting President Reagan, 52 Americans held captive in Iran for 444 days are released following an agreement in which the United States agrees to return $8 billion in frozen assets to Iran. Later it was revealed that the release was delayed until the inauguration in a PR ploy orchestrated by the Reagan handlers to make him look good. What a hero. Also on January 20, 1996 in Palestine, Yasser Arafat wins 88% of the vote in the first Palestinian elections. Israel and the United States under Bush, campaigns of, quote, democracy, unquote, do everything in its power, short of assassination, to topple him, including Israel's support of Hamas. Last year, Hamas wins the Palestinian elections, and Israel and the United States under Bush Jr. do everything they can to topple Hamas. To this date, Israel is in violation of more UN resolution regarding Palestinians than any other country's violations. Almost three times as many Israeli violations than the excuse that was used to invade Iraq. And the beat and the beatings and the killings go on.
And on this day in 2001 and 2005, inauguration ceremonies were held in Washington, D.C., acknowledging George Bush in the role of American president. In 2001, the true winner of the previous year's presidential election had yet to be determined, when after an embarrassingly close race in which Bush's Democratic challenger Al Gore declined to differentiate his platform from Bush's, the vote tally in Florida remained too close to call and was widely disputed. Gore was then later shown to have won Florida's popular vote, but that evidence was suppressed when the U.S. Supreme Court halted the recount in that state. Gore conceded prematurely in 2001, but not as hastily as Bush's 2004 challenger, John Kerry. There, in another embarrassingly close race, evidence of electoral fraud in Ohio suggested the election results there may have been fictitiously skewed in Bush's favor. Kerry, however, conceded the day after the votes were cast.
As Stalin once said, those who cast the vote decide nothing. Those who count the votes decide everything. This week in Radical History for January 21st, 1801, a mysterious fire sweeps the offices of the Department of Treasury, destroying books and papers. After Republicans demand proof that the expenditures of Timothy Pickering, a recently replaced Federal Secretary of War, could be properly accounted for. Also on January 21st in 1920, the Palmer Red Raids begin, targeting labor activists and radicals from the United States government repression. Attorney General Palmer orders the roundup of all suspected and are prosecuted and deported where possible. Thousands of people were arrested in nationwide sweep. Most arrests are illegal, without warrants or justification. Also on this date in 1968, four thermonuclear bombs lost when a B-52 crashes in North Star Bay, Greenland. There are reports of over 200 nuclear bombs lost over the years, and those are the ones that we know of. Also on this date in 1977, President Jimmy Carter issues unconditional pardons to most Vietnam draft resistors on his first full day in office. This pardon affects between 100,000 and 500,000 people. Wouldn't it be very nice if Obama pardons the roughly 2,000 Iraq Vet war resistors now living underground in Canada? I ain't gonna hold my breath. This week in Radical History for January 22, 1903 in Panama, U.S. gets a 99-year lease and sovereignty over the Panama Canal after engineering a coup in favor of U.S. takeover.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on January 22, 1905 in Russia, Bloody Sunday, a massacre of demonstrators in St. Petersburg. Troops open fire on 100,000 workers, women and children. Over 1,000 be killed, and it is the beginning of the first Russian Revolution. Tomorrow the anarchists form part of the first Soviet, created to assist victims of the repression. This year sees a widespread of anarchist movement, which later will be suppressed by the Bolsheviks.
You keep saying you got something for me, but confess, you've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we have for you a program recorded at Harvard Law School exclusively for This Week in Palestine. It is an exploration of international law as it relates to the U.S.-Israeli occupation of Palestine. Of course, international law applies to all signatory countries, although the U.S. and Israel, when they decide that the law should not apply to them, have no problem flouting it, as you will soon hear about. Here is Jamil Dakwar of the ACLU, introduced at a student-sponsored event at the Harvard Law School.
Let me introduce Jamil. As you know, he's director of the ACLU Human Rights Program, which is dedicated to holding the U.S. government accountable to its international human rights obligations. Mm-hmm. He leads a team of lawyers and advocates who use a human rights framework to complement existing ACLU legal and legislative advocacy, primarily in areas of counterterrorism, racial justice, immigrants' rights, women's rights, and criminal and juvenile justice. So HRP's docket includes domestic lawsuits and petitions before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Jamil also serves as the ACLU main representative to the United Nations and has testified about human rights violations in the U.S. before the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, UN human rights bodies, and several other treaty bodies. So prior to joining the ACLU, Jamil worked at Human Rights Watch, where he worked on issues of torture and detention in Egypt, Morocco, Israel, and the occupied Palestinian territories. He was a senior attorney with Adala, which is a leading human rights organization in Israel, where he filed and argued human rights cases before the Israeli courts. He's a graduate of Tel Aviv University and NYU School of Law and an adjunct lecturer at John Jay College, College of Criminal Justice, and now a Wasserstein Fellow here for a few days. So thank you, Jamil. And I will be asking Jamil some questions, and then we'll open it up to a broader conversation. So I want to start off, you know, we're going to talk about, because of your expertise in the Middle East and the U.S., and given your experience as a human rights lawyer in Israel, I was wondering if you can start us off by discussing the challenges of holding Israel accountable, first domestically, for human rights violations, and recent examples that may illustrate this.
First, thank you very much for the invitation, and so great to be here with you all and for the sponsoring organizations. It's always good to be back at Harvard. I would start by saying, first of all, some part of my speech, particularly the ones that are related to Israel, since I'm not, I don't work on Israel directly as an ACLU representative, these words or these comments will not represent the ACLU. So, but as a free speech organization, ACLU tolerate me being outspoken on Palestinian rights issues, particularly in the connections between what happens in Israel, Palestine, and what's happening in the United States. And so I do take advantage of that, and I'm really glad to have that opportunity here. So I think I would start with really what I would say is the shrinking accountability opportunities, both at the domestic level, and we see that increasingly happening in Israel. I just came back in May. I was there with a delegation of activists, and some of them are lawyers, but also 2 years ago we had another legal delegation of, and one of the things that was really striking to us to see is that how it's much more difficult to really do something that will make it have a deterrent effect on the government from not doing a worse, adopting a worse policy or taking a worse action, particularly when it comes to Palestinian human rights. And in that regard, I would, for the sake of the conversation, I would talk about Palestinian human rights, not just in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, and those who live in Gaza under siege, but also Palestinians who are citizens of Israel. Because we see that there's a lot of policies and a lot of laws that were adopted in the last several years that would be unthinkable in the way that we see them now being adopted by the Knesset, by the parliament, and with very little scrutiny, particularly when it comes to judicial scrutiny, given that there's also changes that happened to the Israeli Supreme Court and the judiciary over the years. And we see that, for example, and when it comes to issues of land and housing and planning policies, this is where there's a greater deference to the government when it comes to use of force and invoking national security in order to justify certain policies, whether it comes to citizenship rights, residency rights of Palestinians, from those who live inside Israel to those who live in East Jerusalem and being subject to stripping their residency rights, we see, again, deference to, or most of the time, again, there are exceptions here and there. And so we see that there's a lack of accountability that has become more of the norm. In the past, whereas I think there was a constant struggle. You've been able to find a margin within the Israeli society that you'd be open to what you're really, when you're advocating for Palestinian rights. There's always an exception for Palestinian rights. So there would be, Israel had a robust legal system and a rule of law that really would protect individual rights. But when it comes to Palestinian rights, there was always an exception to that rule. When it comes to the Palestinians who reside or live in the West Bank, or whether in Gaza, or the ones who are living inside Israel, and especially in cases where national security is at stake, then it becomes even more difficult to even entertain or to be able to advance any successful legal advocacy on their behalf. So that was one of the things that we've seen, and particularly in the area of use of force. The recent case that was decided by the Israeli Supreme Court, which basically approved the government use of live ammunition and snipers at the southern border or southern fence or a boundary with Gaza against protesters, largely peaceful protesters, just indicates that where the direction of approving such policies. And in comparison, I think that one of the things that I see here in the U.S. when I work on these is that you are similarly seeing again, lack of ability to have a full accountability, particularly when it comes to the way that the judiciary is changing, the way that we're looking at our international law obligations, the way that we're looking at use of force standards and enforcement and mechanisms of oversight that we had and now almost non-existent under the current administration, particularly with the Justice Department, and even with the last policy that was made by Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, on his way out, basically undermining consent decrees that were reached between the police under supervision of federal courts. But I would like to go into more details, but I think the real one other thing that I want to highlight is the way that in the international accountability piece, which usually had complemented the domestic accountability. While the United States is a very powerful country with a lot of diplomatic, economic, military power over all over the world and has a lot of saying in international organizations. Israel, on the other hand, is always is a smaller country, so it needed to show that it's actually trying to play by the rules, and had and that particularly was evident in a way that, for example, the Supreme Court would at least consider some international law arguments, because there was an attempt, particularly under the leadership of the Chief Justice, the former Chief Justice Aaron Barak, and later on Dorit Benesch. To show that there is a sort of a judicial scrutiny and a rule of law that would dismiss any attempt to hold the country accountable internationally. Because as part of the complementarity, particularly in the context of international criminal responsibility, that has become a major challenge for the state of Israel, for Israeli officials, particularly security agencies from the military to the Shabak in the interrogation practices. We can talk more about that. And so we see that there's sort of U.S. and Israel is almost becoming in the same place where they are pushing back against international accountability, particularly when it comes to the ICC. Some of you may have researched or talked about that, but I want to elaborate a little more about that because that's really an interesting angle of looking at ways that Israel and the U.S. are becoming so close as far as their attitude toward the court.
That's actually my next question is, we talked about the domestic front, but what are the challenges of holding Israel accountable internationally for its violations, and how are they similar and different to the challenges of holding the U.S. accountable? I'm thinking about, we could also get into why the U.S. and Israel haven't ratified the Rome Statute. You can give us a little bit of a 101 contextualization before you go into that.
Sure. So historically, I mean, it's interesting that when the Rome Statute was negotiated, you know, the U.S. actually signed it after 1998 during the Clinton administration. And then the Bush administration came to power and they basically decided to what is called unsigning, although there's no such a thing under international law. But they made it very clear that they are shifting. They are not going to engage with the court. That attitude changed over time from a very, very hostile attitude with Congress passing ASPA, the American Member Service Members Protection Act, in August of 2002, signing over 100 agreements, immunity agreement with other countries, making sure that other countries would not extradite U.S. military or agents that would be complicit in war crimes as part of the post 9/11, the war in Afghanistan, later on the war in Iraq, and the so-called war on terror, and all the practices that we now know because they were very well documented and exposed both in official and unofficial documents, particularly around the use of torture, the use of arbitrary detention and indefinite detention and so forth. So the policy of the U.S. government was shifted over the time. They were very hostile. Then the Bush administration, toward the end of the Bush administration, started to open up in terms of cooperating with the ICC while at the same time not agreeing to ratify the Rome Statute, but helping the ICC. Particularly, there was the critical point was the case against the president of Sudan, Bashir, where he was indicted by the ICC, and they really needed the U.S. support and cooperation, which was given by the Bush administration. And so that is the constructive engagement became more central during the Obama years. So they continued we will cooperate with the ICC on different international investigations or preliminary examination. We will support the court, but we will not subject the U.S. Personnel. We will not be cooperating with the ICC on anything that relates to United States government officials. And not only that, during the Obama years, the United States went abroad to block international investigations related to war crimes and use of torture overseas by the Bush administration. For example, you can see that now they have WikiLeaks cables that were released or leaked, which confirmed that how during the Bush administration, but also during the Obama administration, there were attempts to go to German prosecutors, the German authorities, as well as to Spanish authorities, and to convince them and persuade them and pressure them, and particularly in Germany, there was like really a threat that this will have diplomatic and other ramifications and consequences if the German case, particularly in the case of the torture of Khaled al-Masri, who was a German citizen, would move forward with the indictment against 13 CIA agents. And it succeeded, even though there was an indictment of 13 undercover agents, and the Germany asked to extradite them. The U.S. obviously said, no way, we will not cooperate, we will not extradite them, and the case was dropped. Basically, now there is no no extradition request anymore. German authorities kind of succumbed to the pressure. So where are we now? Now we reach the U.S. position after Obama administration kind of had this dual attitude toward the Corps. We support you, but don't dare to come close to U.S. personnel. Now with the under the Trump administration, we see back to more hostile attitude towards the court, with John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, coming out with a speech on September 10th of this year, threatening the ICC, if it moves forward with an investigation concerning Afghanistan, to prosecute, no less than prosecute, judges and prosecutors of the ICC, to file criminal charges against them in the United States, to go after their assets, if they have assets in the United States, to block their travel, to issue a travel ban against them. Outrageous and unprecedented threats that only a country, that an authoritarian country, would issue against any judge or a prosecutor. And so you say, why? What happened? Why did that get to this point? So what part of it is John Bolton? You know, this is part of his career of dismissing anything that has to do with international attempt to hold the United States accountable, but he does it in his own way, and so there's a lot of grandstanding that is involved in that. I don't think that there's any authority that the United States has to prosecute judges and lawyers unless there would be changes in laws, so they would go to Congress, and fortunately, there's no way that the Congress will cooperate on that. But still, just having that threat sends a chilling effect on anybody who would cooperate. Now, the threat was not only against the judges and the prosecutors. It also was against any other company or state that cooperates with the ICC, not only related to the United States' involvement in torture in Afghanistan and three other countries that are members to the court, Poland, Romania, and Lithuania, but also any country that would cooperate with the ICC or any company or state that provides assistance to U.S. allies and particularly to Israel. And that brings me to the Israel side, where in Israel, the initial position of the Israeli government was, we may be considered joining, and we were like sitting on the fence. The former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Aharon Barak, called on the government to ratify the Rome Statute. Many people don't know that fact, but that actually actually happened. So there was a sort of like, what do we have? If we are operating under the rule of law, if we have our own system of accountability, why would we have to be concerned about joining the ICC? Because ultimately, the ICC is a court of the last resort. It is not a court it would initiate criminal prosecution or criminal investigation. It would take years to do that. It was very robust, very, very... there's a lot of checks and balances, a lot of safeguards against kind of, exploitation of that process, right? And so the question is whether the government, the country, is complying, has its own judicial system first, has a system of accountability that is genuine, that is credible, that provides a accountability, that where there's independence between the military command and the investigative bodies? Is that something where you can really see that the government's really able and willing to kind of do these genuine, thorough investigations? And in the last several years, we've seen that the government has proven again and again that it's not willing and it's unable, but it's also precisely because it's not only unable, but it's engaged in such conduct and such actions that is undermining any kind of accountability. It's really whitewashing war crimes, and all of the different attempts to hold anybody accountable were really non-existent. I mean, I can give you examples, just the numbers.
Khan al-Ahmar, so if we think about the High Court of Justice ruling approving demolitions of the Palestinian community, a village of Khan al-Ahmar, and how now Israel's feeling pressured from the ICC to cooperate with investigations, what is the interplay with that, if you can talk about?
Yeah, that's a great example of a recent example. Khan al-Ahmar is a one part of a larger community of about 1,500 Palestinian Bedouin community that is scattered in that area of east of Jerusalem. So it's just very close to Maale Adumim. I don't know if people know the area. It's in the West Bank, so it's an occupied territory. But it's very close to areas where a settlement want to expand and potentially could break the West Bank in two parts. That would not allow that kind of connection between the two. This community was actually already a victim of forced displacement from the 1950s. It was moved in the 1950s after Israel was created and under the military regime that existed between 48 and 66, where all Palestinian citizens were under that military regime, including the Bedouin community who lived in the Naqab in the south of Israel. So they were forcibly moved from the Naqab area, from Tel Arad, all the way into the area around Jerusalem. The name, part of that, also there's a Jahalin Bedouin tribe that, and were consistently, I remember when I was living there and practicing law, this is a consistent threat of displacement. Like literally, like people, I don't think that they ever lived in a time when they felt like, oh my God, there's no threat of being displaced. And so now they were living in an area where they have been pushed to this particular area. They actually were able to get at some point leases to lease some land to farm. But at that point, the area where they reside now was targeted for settlement expansion. The policy of not providing permits to build, not to hook them up with basic local services, water, electricity, had made the community much more difficult to survive that. There's a school that serves not just Khan al-Ahmar, but serves the outside, the surrounding Bedouin community. So you're talking about you're talking about 150 people where be potentially with the school being demolished would be even have an impact on the other community. So now what happened is that they took their case to the courts, as they did over the years, and their first attempt, the first petition after a long time of legal battle was dismissed by the court, and basically the court approved the destruction of the village. So basically, you can't live in this area because you don't have permits. You have not authorized to live there. And so it's like as if you're talking in place where you can easily go to some ministry office and say, oh, I want to build here, and you grant it easily, or you can challenge that in a way but there is no building permits given, particularly for Palestinians who live in Area C. After the Oslo Accords in 1993, 60% of the West Bank was declared as Area C, that is exclusively under Israeli security and civilian control. That means that Israeli authorities control not only the security there, but also controls the living conditions, permits, expansion. And this is the area where it's also discussed as potential area for expansion of settlements and potentially also annexed to Israel as part of the at least proposals by this extreme government that we have. So the Khan al-Ahmar is a model of a community that is said, well, we want to play by the rules. Give us a chance to get permits. We've been here. We were forced to move from another, from one place to another, and yet the court, the Supreme Court, dealt with them as if it were they were really squatters, or as if they were just people who trespassed the area, and they're just sitting there, and they had options to get a permit. The latest round of litigation, they got that decision in May, and there was another filing in July for another petition. They went back to the court and they said, these demolitions really can't come work because the plan that was offered by the government is not reasonable. They're offering us to move to an area where it's near a dump, a garbage dump, or that is in toxic, it's an area that it's environmentally dangerous. It's not some place where we go. And not only that, the government was trying to say, the agreement to move you, you have to sign voluntarily that you're going to be stripped of your rights. They're not only this community, but all the other communities. So they kind of tied their future with the other communities, which other communities are also battling their presence and defending against forced displacement. So it became impossible for them to agree to such offer. So they went to the court, and the court again said, well, we don't think that we can intervene. We already said what we said in our decision in back in May, and again dismissed the last call for remedy and justice. So right now what was happening in the middle of all of that, the ICC took notice. The International Criminal Court Prosecutor's Office has a preliminary investigation against the Israeli government, particularly related to Gaza, but also has expanded to the West Bank, particularly around the settlement buildings that are illegal under international law, particularly would violate the Rome Statute. For some of you who say, well, how does it, like the ICC prosecutor, have jurisdiction when Israel has not ratified the treaty? Well, what happened is that Palestine, which has an observer status at the United Nations and have been considered as an international entity, signed and ratified the ICC. There was a long battle between Israel and the Palestinians over whether the Palestinians within that circumscribed or limited status that they have internationally can actually become party to the ICC. And they won that battle. So now they are a member of the ICC, which means that in the areas that are for what is recognized as 67 border, the ICC has jurisdiction potentially to investigate commission of war crimes. Unless, of course, that there are other investigative processes that would prevent an investigation. So Khan al-Ahmar was a place where the ICC issued a statement that said that it is monitoring the case, just as it also issued a statement of warning against the use of live ammunition in the Gaza against the protesters, but also issued a warning that all parties to the situation in Gaza, particularly around the protests, if, for example, civilians are being used as human shield, they would be subject to the ICC. That's included in that preliminary investigation. Again, it's a preliminary examination. I have to be very accurate. Not an investigation. So it's not a full investigation. It's not clear whether we would move into a full investigation anytime soon. But that had already had, in my view, some deterrent effect, which in the United States, it would be different. The Israeli government is indirectly cooperating with the ICC, particularly around the 2014 military operations in Gaza, which resulted mass civilian killings. We don't know the details of that, but it was reported in Haaretz just a couple of days ago, which for me means that they are trying to work indirectly, meaning through third parties, because they don't want to give the court, the prosecutor's office, any legitimacy. Oh, we recognize you. So they're doing it through a third party. It's not clear who is doing that on behalf of the Israeli government, but that also gives you a sense that it matters. as to what the ICC is doing. Now, obviously, you would say, well, it's going to take time until this investigation will result of any kind of prosecutions or indictments. And even then, what will happen? You know, so there's that. That's true. I mean, ICC is not the answer. Prosecution is not the answer to what's the mass violation of human rights, particularly it's not the answer to ending whether the occupation or the settlement activities, which are illegal. But at least it plays a role now when other governments are not acting, when particularly U.S. administration is so supportive of the Israeli government and giving that diplomatic, legal, economic support to it, including its Israeli settlement, it is important to have some sort of a process where it is a judicial body that may have an impact, at least as far as deterring and make some Israelis fear the idea of even traveling. I mean, if in down the road, just like many of the Israeli officials, even former officials who acted on behalf of the U.S. government, of the Israeli government, if they travel to Europe, they make sure that they have some sort of an immunity attached to their visit, particularly to places like the U.K. And after Elmog, who was a former southern commander of the Israeli forces, and he was almost arrested because there was an investigation against him for commission of war crimes, mass home demolitions in Rafah area in the 2003-2004, and that investigation was real imminent in the sense of he could have been arrested and investigated and potentially prosecuted in the UK for his actions as a military commander. So there's a lot of concerns about that, and I think it may have an impact on the way that the Israeli government is conducting itself, particularly with regard to some of the mechanisms that were created over the years. We can talk about that, like the Turkle Commission and how the Marvi Marmara, you know, was dealt with and so on.
Okay, just going back, Jamil had mentioned a lot of recent shifts in U.S. policy, and I would also say it can be quite arguable. Is it really a shift with Israeli policy, the new nation-state bill? So I want to ask Jamil, you know, when we're talking about Israeli shifts in policy, what will be the impact of this bill? Some people working on this issue have said it's been de facto this way, but what are you seeing as the actual kind of results of what will happen after this nation-state bill? You can describe it. And also the U.S. has moved its embassy to Jerusalem, has cut funding for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which is the primary supporting agency for Palestinian refugees. What are the impacts of these shifts, and what any accountability measures do we have?
I think I see the latest bill, the Jewish Nation State bill, is continuation of a policy. I mean, there are other laws that were adopted that clearly were attempted to what we would call it as delegitimization of Palestinian citizenship rights in Israel. You know, Israel has launched a campaign calling that it is being delegitimized at the United Nations, for example. That's something that a lot of people hear about. But people don't hear about the state of Israel launching its own delegitimization campaign or reaffirm that. I mean, because I think that's been a constant campaign going on for years. But the forces in Israel were debating how to do it. Do we do it the confrontational way, the straightforward way, or we do it in a way that would be, you know, looking at we are still looking like a democratic state, and we have individual rights and minority rights, and we compared to other countries in the Middle East, we're doing well. So that debate within the Israelis, society within the Israeli political system, has shifted towards the forces that say we have nothing to be ashamed of being called apartheid state, if that means we are going to say there are certain laws that protect and give rights only to Jews, and there are not going to be those rights afforded to non-Jewish citizens. So this is where we are now. We are in a place where some of the policies that were adopted since 1948, when Israel was created, that were both de facto and de jure, but de facto in the sense that that was the policy of excluding Palestinians from decision-making, from planning and housing policies, or were actually directed against them. There's not a single family, Palestinian family, an Arab family in Israel, that was not subjected to land confiscation by the official policy. What here we would call like, you know, an eminent domain, like the confiscation for public interest. It is a model that existed because the idea was that it's a center purpose of the country, is that this is a Jewish state first, and then it is having a democratic structure, its democratic nature. You can debate how far it goes. Israel's Declaration of Independence had to include certain protections and at least guarantees of safeguards for non-Jewish residents, because of the fact that as part of the UN partition plan of 1947, for the Jewish state that was to be created on part of the historic Palestine, it had to include protections against minorities, particularly against confiscation of property. That is part of the partition plan of 47. And so for Israelis, for the founding of the state, it was important to project, we want to join the family of nations. We want to be a democratic state. There's we want to have the rule of law. We want to protect individual rights. And they attempted to put that in the Declaration of Independence. They put that in some laws. But the core laws, whether the basic laws around even protecting the land of Israel, Chok Yisod Mikarkei Israel, you know, there's been, it's just like, you know, no country thinks about it. It's only the, you know, first thing you do in a basic law, instead of addressing basic human rights, you're addressing what is the land of Israel is going to look like, in which hands it will be. Basically centralizing the control over land so that no one, the private property will be reduced. So you'd have a situation now where your 93-94% of the land of Israel is controlled by the government. It is leased to people to build, you know, to obviously developing towns and there, but you have a lease 49 years, 100 years. You don't have private property. The only private property that exists is actually within Palestinian indigenous community. And that shrunk over the years because of confiscation of land. So the land and housing policy has been always a de facto, and I would say de jure, a policy of segregation, a policy of separate but not equal. You have over 450 towns and villages were destroyed in 1948, and during the war in 1948. Israel built hundreds of new villages and towns and settlements inside Israel, not a single one to the Palestinian community, except for the purpose of concentrating Arab Bedouins in townships in the Naqab. And these are failed towns. I mean, unfortunately, the highest ranking, the highest unemployment, the worst education, health, I mean, everything is like in because they really went against the interest of this community that was more indigenous, semi-nomadic community in the Naqab. So that law is basically came to affirm things that already existed, but put it in a way that kind of just drop the fig leaf, and this is what we stand for. And you can go back to writings. I remember Ariel Sharon in 1992. He wrote. He had a column in Yedot Ahronot, and he wrote an article that said about Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. And that article, I think it's very important, because he said, we didn't come to Israel to be necessarily a democratic state. We started the state as a Jewish state first, and then as a democratic. So what are the priorities? What comes first? I think this law makes it very clear that Israel wants to be a nation state, or more of a state that has what now people call it more and more increasingly a Zionist supremacist state, where if you are, and that's why you see a law for loyalty in cultural issues. You have to be loyal to the state in culture. You see cracking down on dissent. You see all these shrinking of democratic space that was always been marginal, particularly for Palestinians. So That is a continuation, but I think now the question is, what would be the reaction for, first, there's a challenge before the Israeli Supreme Court. In January, there would be the first argument. The case that was brought by Adala, the group that I work with, represents all the Palestinian leadership and political parties. So basically, the case on behalf of 1.5 million citizens. Obviously, there are the margin of Israeli citizens that support that case. But it's a very interesting to see what would the court will say. And then what will be the international ramifications of that? Because now the people are looking at the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination and looking at the Convention on the Suppression of the Crime of Apartheid and looking at the definition and say, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? Is that an apartheid or not? Does it meet the definition? Are we talking just about apartheid in segregation that's happening in the West Bank under the occupation, where we already have separate roads, we already have separate settlements, separate legal systems, separate everything, right? So there is now the first time that I think Israel is confronting this. Is it going to be able to push back and continue to enjoy this myth of being a democratic state when it's treating 20% of its citizens as second, if not third class citizens? And lastly, I would say, it will be interesting how that is going to play out here. We already see how many of the lobbying groups that lobby for the State of Israel's interests are launching campaigns to defend the occupation, defend the apartheid regime in the West Bank, and they would go to defend what's happening inside. So I think it would be interesting to what, now we saw that how they're now pushing many states to pass anti-BDS legislation. Not that, you know, you've seen any state divesting from Israeli companies. Not that we were seeing, like, in any way there's a danger that all of a sudden, you know, Americans are becoming, you know, anti-Semitic in the way that they're trying to redefine anti-Semitism, which is one thing that I'm concerned about, because a lot of what is being pushed forward, if I am speaking here to you and I'm advocating for Palestinian rights and I'm exposing and you are hearing this analysis, I would be, under this new definition of anti-Semitism, I would be considered an anti-Semitic speaker.
And how has the silence, my last question, I want to open it up, how has the silenced speech and how has the ACLU defended the right to boycott? You mentioned the anti-BDS legislation and that they are tied to the kind of a quest to suppress dissent in Israel, as you can see with the funding and the ties. But where do you see, like, the future of advocacy strategies, I guess, given this, this push to quell dissent?
Yeah, I think we see that there's a crackdown on dissent, particularly around groups that are advocating for human rights. So we see that in Israel in the context of the smear campaigns against Israeli human rights defenders and human rights organizations. We see that in different laws that now, you know, they would have to be, they would be considered like a foreign agents, particularly when they are lobbying in the parliament, because they, the Likud and right-wing government said, well, these groups are getting a lot of government funding from the European countries, and on the other hand, Jewish conservative right-wing groups get more individual donations, not government donations. So they were able to pass a law that would. So there's a lot of. There's also the new law that would even prevent and prohibit people and deny entry to people who would be supporters of a nonviolent means of calling for a boycott of the State of Israel, which is now being implemented in a most secretive way, in a most authoritarian way, of depending most of the information on a secretive website that is funded by right-wing extremist American donors that is basically smearing anybody who is advocating for Palestinian rights, and particularly students who are active in student groups. So this kind of notion of you know, protecting the... You're not supposed to do this kind of calling Israel... Israeli military war crimes, or you can't, you know, expose what we are defending. You know, we have to be loyal to the country. And then we're seeing that that has an impact on the free speech rights in the United States, because you have over 24 or 25 states that either passed legislation or executive orders that would basically restrict the rights of individuals and other entities to engage in a political boycott. The ACLU had made it clear that these laws have no place in an American legal system. The right to political boycott is protected speech under the First Amendment. We already successfully challenged two such laws in Kansas and Arizona. We have two federal bills that are pending that, again, the lobby that is trying to protect Israel's occupation and even blurring the line between the 67 borders and the 1948 border, they are pushing for that, including redefining what is anti-Semitism. So if you are basically making any activity or speech that is seen to be anti-Israel or against the political ideology of Zionism, you would be considered, that would be considered anti-Semitic. It's not just the hatred toward Jews, and the whole, all of a sudden, the threat is coming from these small groups that are advocating for political boycott, using human rights language, raising awareness on the conditions of people and advocating for the right of everybody to live in dignity and equality. They are the main target, while the white nationalists, the new Nazis, are going and even committing one of the worst crimes in American history with the latest anti-Semitic crime, hate crime in Pittsburgh. So I think we need to really put things in perspective and see where is that going. And while I obviously, we don't take, the ACLU doesn't take a position on BDS, on the boycott of Israel, it really protects the right to boycott. I personally have a different opinion, and I have the right to do it, and I'm happy to say that here and everywhere else, because these kinds of way of pushing back against policies that are clearly taking the country into a direction that is much worse than we have seen ever, is important for people to use those tools of boycott and divestment, and we should not be infringing on their rights to do so.
Thank you, Jamil. Thank you, Jamil, for your time. Just a quick round.
You have been listening to Jamil Dhakwar on the national staff of the ACLU speaking at the Harvard Law School. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bass, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 734 of Unwelcome Guests, The Case of the Missing Inquest. I'm Robin Upton, and that title points to, I think, the most suspicious circumstance around a highly suspicious event, the death of UK weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly, perhaps uniquely amongst recent unnatural deaths. There was no coroner's inquiry as to how and why his death came about. Instead, there was a rather toothless inquiry headed by a hand-picked appointee of Tony Blair himself. Now, we begin this show with a speech by Norman Baker MP, who took a year away from the Shadow Cabinet in order to research a book, The Strange Death of Dr. David Kelly, and I think this is from 2009.
As you've heard, I gave up a year of my front bench role to look at this matter. And I did so because it seems to me the events of 2003 are of critical importance to this country still, in terms of how we are run, how those responsible for government behave, what the morality or otherwise of those in government is. And there is unfinished business from 2003. There's unfinished business in terms of the Iraq War. There's unfinished business in terms of David Kelly's death. We have an opportunity to pursue that now because the Chilcot inquiry is now underway. That's allegedly an independent inquiry to investigate the run-up to the Iraq War, the war itself, the conduct of the war, and the aftermath. I've met Sir John Chilcot, and I've raised with him issues of concern to me, including David Kelly's death. It's unfinished business because what happened in 2003 was a disgrace to this country, an affront to democracy, and cannot be allowed to happen again. Those responsible must be brought to book. Let me run through that in some detail. You may recall in the run-up to the war in 2003, we were told in increasingly strident terms by Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell and others, how the threat from Saddam Hussein was increasing, how it was necessary to try to head off these weapons of mass destruction which he had, how the UN had to be engaged in a desperate attempt to avoid war, and how at the last minute it was not possible to avoid war and very reluctantly we had to go and undertake that overseas expedition. Of course, the truth is entirely different to that. Tony Blair was asked on the 8th of July 2003 by the liaison committee, that's a senior committee of committee chairs in the House of Commons, when it was he decided to go to war. He said, "I decided that we could not avoid conflict in the few days before the vote on 18th of March, because it was then that it was obvious that we could not get a second UN resolution to deliver an ultimatum to Saddam. Up until that point, I was still working to avoid the conflict." So we're led to believe by Tony Blair that he decided only 3 months earlier, or 4 months earlier in March 2003, that that was when war was inevitable. Interestingly, subsequently, there emerged in the Sunday Times a memo written by Matthew Rycroft, the Prime Minister's private secretary, taken in July 2002, which was headed, "This record is extremely sensitive, no further copies should be made," which is doubtless how it got to the Sunday Times. And it reports on the discussions between Sir Richard Dearlove, then the head of MI6, quaintly known as C, and this is what he is recorded as having told Tony Blair and the cabinet, or elements of the cabinet. "C reported on his recent talks in Washington There was a perceptible shift in attitude. Military action was now seen as inevitable. Bush wanted to remove Saddam through military action, justified by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD. But the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. July 2002. And what was the response of British ministers to that assessment from the head of MI6 at that point? Was it horror that the Americans are going to break international law? Was it a determination to use our so-called special relationship to rein them in? No, this is what Jack Straw, as Foreign Secretary, is recorded as saying in July 2002. It seemed clear that Bush had made up his mind to take military action, even if the timing was not yet decided. But the case was thin. Saddam was not threatening his neighbours, and his WMD capability was less than that of Libya, North Korea, or Iran. We should work up a plan for an ultimatum for Saddam to allow back in the UN weapons inspectors. This would also help with a legal justification for the use of force. So there's no doubt that ministers had decided in July 2002 to go to war. That's absolutely clear. At the very latest, they may have decided even earlier than that. And what happened after July 2002 and between then and March 2003 was a whole series of dossiers were produced, the famous dodgy dossiers, designed to convince parliamentarians and the public at large that the threat from Saddam was increasing and the military action was to be inevitable. That was a disgraceful deception when we were told, first of all, that no war had been decided upon and there had been, and then information was manufactured to justify the case for war. Hans Blix, the UN weapons inspector, subsequently said that the British government had taken the advice from the security services, the intelligence, and had changed question marks into exclamation marks. In other words, they corrupted the system for political ends. Tony Blair, that man again, said to the House of Commons this: there was no attempt at any time by any official or minister or member of No. 10 Downing Street staff to override the intelligence judgments of the Joint Intelligence Committee. That includes the judgment about the so-called 45 minutes. We were 45 minutes from doom, as you may remember, according to the headline in some of the papers. It was a judgment made by the Joint Intelligence Committee and them alone, which is contrary to what Hans Blix subsequently said about the interference. And I'm afraid the evidence is that Hans Blix was correct, because we now know from the various drafts of the dossiers released that each one became stronger than the last, until the last one, which was finally released, was sufficiently strong to serve its political purpose. There were 16 textual alterations suggested by Alistair Campbell. This is the Prime Minister's press officer, remind you, not an intelligence officer, no access to intelligence data. He was suggesting textual alterations. For example, he suggested that instead of maybe a threat, it should be is a threat, which strikes me as not simply presentational changes, but changes to the whole thrust of the document. When it was quite plain in the initial drafts that London was not threatened directly, the 45 minutes related to battlefield conditions, the explanation that it related to battlefield conditions was removed, thereby allowing the Sun and the Evening Standard to run headlines 45 minutes from doom. Sir Roderick Braithwaite, you may not have heard of him, Sir Roderick Braithwaite, was a former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee. And this is what he wrote in the Financial Times subsequent to the war. A spectre is stalking British television, a frayed and waxy zombie straight from Madame Tussauds. This one, unusually, seems to live and breathe. Perhaps it comes from the Central Intelligence Agency's box of technical tricks, programmed to spout the language of the White House in an artificial English accent. There is another possible explanation. Perhaps what we see on television is the real Tony Blair, the man who believes that he and his friend have the key to the horrifying problems of the Middle East. Mr. Blair's prime responsibility is to defend the interests of his own country. This he has signally failed to do. Stiffened opinions, but often in the wrong, he has manipulated public opinion, sent our soldiers into distant lands for ill-conceived purposes, misused the intelligence agencies to serve his ends, and reduced the Foreign Office to a demoralized cipher because it keeps reminding him of inconvenient facts. He keeps the dog, but barely notices if it barks or not. He prefers to construct his foreign policy out of self-righteous soundbites and expensive foreign travel. And may I remind you, that was the former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee, the senior body of officials looking at intelligence for the government. Tony Blair has never been held to account for that. He has, in a matter beyond satire, where does Private Eye go now, been appointed, of course, as a Middle East peace envoy. So we then had a Hutton inquiry. The Hutton inquiry was set up following the death of David Kelly, officially to look into the circumstances surrounding the death of David Kelly, to which obviously I'll return in a lot of detail in a moment. But what Lord Hutton did with his inquiry was to spend the time discussing whether or not the BBC was at fault for the situation which has arisen, including David Kelly's death, or whether it was in some way the government. And surprise, surprise, Lord Hutton concluded that the BBC was guilty of everything and the government was guilty of nothing. It was the most disgraceful so-called inquiry, I think, in this country's history. So disgraceful was it that when we had the results published in January 2004, it forced the resignation of Greg Dyke, the Director General of the BBC, Gavin Davis, the Chairman of the BBC, Andrew Gilligan, the reporter who'd been involved in the story, and led to that spontaneous demonstration of BBC staff as they walked out of Television Centre and stood there defending Greg Dyke in a manner which reminded me of nothing so much as the Prague Spring of 1968 in Czechoslovakia. It was the nadir for the BBC. And then we had the vomit-inducing sight of Richard Ryder, the BBC's number two to the Director General, coming out to make the most obsequious apology to the government for what the BBC had allegedly done. What the BBC had done was report the facts. That's what they'd done. There was a marginal error in Andrew Gilligan's report, but essentially the report which caused so much fuss when he reported that the dossiers had been sexed up, that report was essentially correct. But all those people at the BBC resigned. Nobody from the government resigned over the Iraq war. Nobody. Not the Prime Minister, not the Foreign Secretary, not the Defence Secretary. Nobody. That's the kind of country we have to live in at the moment, and this is why this is unfinished business. We cannot ever allow again a government to behave in that way and to get away with it. And the Chilcot inquiry gives an opportunity at least to bring in political terms that was responsible for that desperate period to book. But then when that report was published in January 2004, and it was clearly so far wrong that it generated ridicule and disbelief in equal measure from the public at large, I wondered if he was so wrong on the issue of the BBC versus the government, whether he's actually right on David Kelly. Because David Kelly, whose death had prompted this whole business, had rather been forgotten in the inquiry. The inquiry centred, as I say, largely on the government and the BBC. And poor old Dr. Kelly didn't feature very much at all. There then appeared a number of letters from eminent and highly qualified medical experts in The Guardian and other newspapers, disputing the suggestion that David Kelly could have died in the way that Lord Hutton described, and suggesting, in fact, it was clinically impossible for him to have done so. Those letters worried me, and I began to look into the matter. And the more I looked into the matter, the more concerned I became. I subsequently wrote an article for the Mail on Sunday in July, I think, that year, 2004, and it generated the biggest response of anything I've ever done in politics. About 1,000 people contacted me by email, letter, telephone. All bar two were supportive of the concern I expressed and urged me to go on with my investigations. The public clearly weren't convinced by Lord Hutton as far as David Kelly was concerned. And as you've heard, I took some time out from my party's front bench when the opportunity arose to look into the matter, and the result is this book, The Strange Death of David Kelly. Let me now turn to the events surrounding David Kelly directly from July 2003. David Kelly had been cleared over a long period of time by the Foreign Office, though less so by the Ministry of Defence. He occupied a curious position of really acting for the Foreign Office, but being technically line-managed by the Ministry of Defence. He'd been cleared by the Foreign Office to engage in discussions with journalists and to give off-the-record briefings, and this had gone back many years. And therefore, for him to meet Andrew Gilligan, as he did at the Charing Cross Hotel, was not out of the ordinary. And he gave him background information, not for direct attribution. What changed, of course, was that the allegation that the government had deliberately sexed up the dossier was highly charged and went to the heart of the case for the Iraq War and the government's behaviour. It was a charge which is essentially proven to be correct subsequently. Anyway, when that was first broadcast, Alistair Campbell and those around him went ballistic and declared war on the BBC and sent large numbers of letters to the BBC on a kind of hourly basis demanding apologies and retractions and everything else. Part of the strategy was to then, I think, involve David Kelly on the government side, whether he wanted to be involved or not. He had gone to the Ministry of Defence to say, I think I might be responsible for this story, inadvertently or otherwise. There was then a decision taken, and the evidence for that is in the book. There was a meeting involving Blair and Jeff Hoon, at which it was deliberately decided to leak Dr. Kelly's name or force it out in order that he could be used as a pawn in the battle between the government and the BBC. Not a very edifying way to deal with a public servant who'd done immense good for his country and for the world, but that was what was decided by those politicians. Subsequently, then, he was outed, thanks to Jeff Hood and others, and that led to his appearance at the Foreign Affairs Committee on the 16th of July 2003, when he faced a difficult time. He wasn't used to the public gaze in that sense, and he was treading a fine line between not making matters worse, I think, in terms of what he said to Andrew Gilligan, while not lying, obviously, to MPs in that session. Now let me give you the official version of events, as Lord Hutton will describe it. The events of that particular committee meeting were harrowing for David Kelly, so Lord Hutton will tell us. He wasn't used to that. He came away thinking his career was at an end. He was very depressed. He then spent a couple of days mulling over it, and on the Thursday, he left his house for the last time, carrying with him his boyhood knife and 30 coproximal tablets with the intention of slitting his wrist, taking the tablets either to aid death or to deal with the pain of the wrist slitting, and there he passed quietly away on Harrowdown Hill. That explanation is wrong in virtually all regards. Let me deal with his mood, first of all. And his mood is, if you like, circumstantial. It's not possible to always be inside someone's mind. But insofar as we can tell what was in his mind, he was certainly not suicidal. First of all, those I've spoken to who know him very well, including UN weapons inspectors, colleagues, close friends, those who live in his village, all will absolutely state that he was the last person in the world to commit suicide. He had dealt with very harsh and difficult episodes, including revealing, forcing out details of an illegal bioweapons program by the Soviet Union, stroke Russia, and indeed the Iraqis in the early 1990s. He was not the person to be intimidated by a bunch of MPs. However, that you might say that we don't know whether that's really what he was like. That's not proof, and I accept that. He went to the Intelligence and Security Committee the next day, on the Wednesday. This is generally not known, but I've got the transcript from that meeting. He gave evidence there. He was in much better form, even cracking jokes. And on the Thursday, the last day of his life, he was sending emails to friends saying the worst was over. I was looking forward to getting back to Iraq, and he actually spoke to the Ministry of Defence and booked a flight to Iraq the following Thursday. Emails were sent at 11:18, shortly before he left the house for the last time. In addition to that, his wife was ill in bed that lunchtime, and his daughter was about to be married. So it had to be a particularly selfish act, I think, for him to have gone to commit suicide at that point. And all the evidence, circumstantial evidence, on his mood suggests that that was a highly unlikely action for him to have taken. However, that is not definitively proven one way or the other. What is much more difficult to rebut is the clear evidence which can be accumulated concerning the alleged method of death. The knife which he was supposed to have used, we never saw it. It was never produced at the Hutton Inquiry, but we're led to believe it was a knife he'd owned since boyhood. It was a sort of gardening knife with a lip on it. It was also a blunt knife. It was the most curious weapon to use if you were out to try and kill yourself. We're told that he cut the ulnar artery. The ulnar artery, for those who aren't medically qualified, and I wasn't and still not, but I've learned about the ulnar artery, is in your hand here. It is only accessed by cutting nerves and tendons. It would have been particularly painful to have cut through nerves and tendons to get to this artery, particularly using the knife which I've just described. It's also an artery of matchstick thickness, and therefore, you might think, unlikely to cause death by loss of blood. Particularly as you use a blunt knife, the wound will heal up more quickly than if you use an absolutely sharp knife. I asked the national statistician, Karen Dunnell, how many people had died from cutting the ulnar artery in 2003 in the whole of the UK. The answer, you may be surprised to know, is one, presumably Dr. Kelly. If you want to, and I'm not suggesting you do want to do this, but if you were to want to cause death by loss of blood, then the suggestion is you might cut your arm this way and put it in hot water. I'm told that's the way you might achieve death. Don't try this at home, as you say on Blue Peter. Many people will assume that what you should do is, in fact, to cut the radial artery across here. And that's what they'll do on television programs. And that, of course, will cause the loss of blood to a far greater degree than it would cutting the ulnar artery. Interestingly, a study of U.S. prisons and attempts by U.S. prisoners to kill themselves by cutting the radial artery in the 1990s showed that, I think of one out of 279 prisoners only was successful in killing themselves by cutting the radial artery, which would have caused a loss of a great deal more blood than cutting the ulnar artery. So even that is uncertain, at the very least, to cause death. It's also the case if you cause a wound of any significance, blood will spurt out because the heart obviously is still beating and pushing the blood round. So you might think, might you not, that in those circumstances there'd be rather a lot of blood around Dr. Kelly's body if he's supposed to have bled to death. Not an unreasonable assumption. Yet when the paramedics arrived on the scene in Harrowdown Hill, they weren't actually clear how he was supposed to have died. Why was that? Because there was no blood. There was no blood evident. The only blood on his clothing was a small spot of blood about the size of a 50p piece on one knee, and his left arm had been was blood-soaked. Consistent, I might also say, with a cut after death rather than one before it. If he was going to have cut his ulnar artery with his right hand, which obviously he would have had to have done, you might have expected blood to have spurted up and to cover his right hand and his right sleeve. Not a single drop of blood, not one, was found on his right hand or his right sleeve. How can this be? Extraordinary feat from David Kelly to be able to cut in that way and leave not a single drop of blood. And there are some other curiosities as well about this knife and the alleged method of death. I asked the Thames Valley Police in a Freedom of Information request subsequent to the Hutton Inquiry, whose fingerprints were on the knife. Do you know what they said? they said to me, I've got it in writing, there were no fingerprints recovered from the knife. Very curious for David Kelly to have been able to cut his ulnar artery without leaving fingerprints. He wasn't wearing gloves either, by the way, just in case you're wondering about that. Mai Pedersen, who was perhaps David Kelly's closest friend, they were Baha'i faith members together. They worked together in Iraq. She was, is in the U.S. Army. I've spoken to her at some length. She says that David Kelly had earlier on that year injured his right elbow quite badly, and when they had a meal together in a restaurant, so bad was the injury, he was unable to cut steak with his right hand. And yet here we are expected to believe that he chose his right hand to cut with a knife into the ulnar artery. David Kelly knew more about the human body than most people. If he had wanted to commit suicide, he could certainly have chosen a more effective and certain way than a method which had killed nobody so far that year in the UK. It is inconceivable a man of his knowledge and intelligence would opt for such a clumsy method to try to kill yourself. Now, we're also told by the Hutton Inquiry that a contributory factor to his death was the ingestion of coproximol tablets. And certainly in his jacket at the scene where he was found, there were three blister packs neatly put in inside his jacket of 10 coproximol tablets each, and altogether 29 tablets were missing. One tablet, for whatever reason, had been left inside in situ. We are then perhaps invited to conclude that David Kelly must have swallowed 29 coproximol tablets. And yet, the official toxicologist at the Hutton Inquiry, Alex Allen, said there was less than half a tablet in his stomach when he was examined. And even if you allow for the possibility that the tablets had metabolized into the bloodstream, he concluded that there was less than half the lethal dose at maximum available to kill him. Coproximol tablets are also implicated in liver failure. Had you taken an overdose of coproximol tablets and failed to kill yourself, you would cause yourself significant long-term liver damage. Again, I don't think it's very likely that someone like David Kelly would have taken that risk. Had he wanted to kill himself, which I don't think he did, but had he wanted to kill himself, I'm sure he wouldn't have chanced long-term liver damage with an uncertain means of suicide. There's another curiosity as well about these coproximol tablets, or quite a few curiosities really, but one of the curiosities is that Mai Pedersen again made it known that David Kelly had an aversion to swallowing tablets. He would avoid doing so. He would take liquid solutions rather than swallowing tablets. So we're invited to believe that David Kelly is suicidal, he's masochistic, and he's illogical. I don't think he was any of those things, as a matter of fact. Now, in order to swallow the tablets, you might think that he would require a good deal of water, because if you try swallowing 29 tablets of coproximol tablets with a long axis, that will require a good degree of water. You might also conclude, as medical opinion suggests, that if you have lost a lot of blood, as we're invited to believe he has done, he's supposed to have bled to death, then the body, in those circumstances, will want to consume water as a compensation. So did he consume a lot of water? There was a water bottle there. It was rather curiously placed, 10 inches from his left shoulder, which is difficult to see how you would put it there. But the water bottle itself was one of those small ones you buy at railway stations for about a pound. It was about half full. So we're invited to believe that in order to swallow 29 tablets and compensate for the loss of blood, he actually only swallowed half a bottle of water. The bottle was smeared with blood. So I asked Thames Valley Police whose fingerprints were on the water bottle. No fingerprints were recovered from the water bottle, they told me, which makes you wonder how the blood got on there. Then there's a position of the body. The volunteers who first found the body, the search volunteers, are adamant that the body was propped against a tree, upright, with the legs spread out and the back against the tree, or at least the head against the tree. And indeed, I suppose we're going to sit in the wood, and if you are going to kill yourself, then that's a logical position to be in. What then happened was that a police officer came along called D.C. Coe. He was left with the body for 25 minutes. And when the paramedics arrived, after D.C. Coe had been there, the paramedics told Lord Hutton the body was on its back, a little distance from the tree. So did D.C. Coe move the body? Well, D.C. Coe was asked about this, and he said he observed the scene from 7 or 8 feet, but got no closer. He was there for 20 to 25 minutes. Now, I don't know about you, but even if you are a professional police officer, I think you would take some notes of what happened and what the scene was. 20 minutes is a long time to do nothing in a wood with no distractions, with the body in front of you. Now, I suggest that you might examine the body. Even if you didn't touch and disturb the scene, you would get rather closer than 7 or 8 feet. It seems a rather curious proposition that D.C. Coe puts forward. So presumably he did monitor the scene, didn't he? Well, no, because he couldn't tell Lord Hutton if if David Kelly had a cap on his head or it was away from the body. He wasn't sure if he was wearing walking boots. He didn't know whether the watch was on the knife or whether it wasn't. Was there water in the bottle? I wasn't sure about that either. He didn't seem to have recorded very much in his 20 to 25 minutes. But we do know that the scene described by the volunteers who found David Kelly is different to the scene described by the paramedics who came subsequently. Not simply the position of the body, but, for example, the volunteers had said that the right arm, David Kelly's right arm, was beside the body. The paramedics said it was on top of his chest. And lots of other changes like that as well. There's also the interesting issue as to what David Kelly was actually wearing. Acting Superintendent David Purnell from Thames Valley Police told the Sunday Times on the 20th of July that David Kelly had left his house, quote, dressed in jeans and a cotton shirt despite the poor weather. That is sort of backed up by his Guardian the day before, the day after Kelly was found, Saturday's Guardian, and the Observer and the Mail on Sunday, which had him, quote, dressed casually in an open neck shirt and jeans with no coat. Curious then that a green barber wax type jacket was found at the scene, his wax jacket, including where the coproximal tablet pack, blister packs were found. Some inconsistencies. You might think that Lord Hutton would want to get to the bottom of this, wouldn't you? You might think that if he's having an inquiry into someone's death, he might want to try to reconcile the various different facts. That, I'm afraid, is not what Lord Hutton sought to do. Lord Hutton, in fact, took a rather interesting approach to the inquiry, as subsequently appeared from a piece he wrote about it in 2005. He wrote this in the Inner Temple Yearbook. Now, it's a racy publication. I'm sure you've come across it, but just in case you haven't, let me read to you what Lord Hutton wrote about his own inquiry 2 years earlier. At the outset of my inquiry, it appeared to me that a substantial number of the basic facts of the train of events that led to the tragic death of Dr. Kelly were already apparent from reports in the press and other parts of the media. Therefore, I thought that there would be little serious dispute as to the background facts. I thought unnecessary time could be taken up by cross-examination on matters which are not directly relevant. That's how Lord Hutton approached his inquiry, in his own words. And therefore, when the police gave conflicting evidence, as they did, about where the body was, what he was wearing, where the water bottle was, how many police officers even were there, because they're all matters which the police themselves contradicted themselves on, what did Lord Hutton do about that? Lord Hutton concluded, he noticed the inconsistencies, and when he reported, he said that the fact that there were inconsistencies shows the police were honest in telling the truth. Because, this is the reason why, stay with it, this is the reason why, because
If the police had all said the same thing, it would suggest they had concocted the story. The fact that they all told different events shows that they were honest but perhaps had poor recollection. That was Lord Hutton's conclusion on that. And then there were interesting moments when it looked like the inquiry might actually get somewhere. Nicholas Hunt, for example, the pathologist, when he was questioned. The first opening salvo to Nicholas Hunt was this from James Dingerman, QC, the QC for the Hunt Inquiry. Quote, "I am not going to trouble you with the details of the toxicology report," was the first thing he said to him. Why not? That's what he's there for. Why not ask him about the toxicology report? He wasn't subject to any cross-examination, despite the curious access, aspects of the case. He was asked, however, at the end of his evidence, which didn't last very long, if you could tell from the examination if there were any signs of a third-party involvement in Dr. Kelly's death. This is what he said, the pathologist. "The features are quite typical, I would say, of self-inflicted injury if one ignores all the other features of the case." So what happened then? Was Dr. Hunt asked what those features were? No. Thank you very much. That's what happened then. He was asked then, was there anything further he would like to say on the circumstances leading to Dr. Kelly's death? This is what he said. "Nothing I could say as a pathologist, no." Rather curious answer, isn't it? You think somebody might want to pursue that point, but nobody did. So how was it that we had such a ludicrous inquiry, a joke of an inquiry, which failed to do what any normal process would do? Answer: it was not a proper inquiry. It was just a statutory inquiry. It was a non-statutory inquiry. Now, that may sound like a rather technical point, but it's actually terribly important. Lord Hutton was appointed with all due speed. For those of us who don't believe the government sometimes acts fast enough and takes a long time to do anything, take heart from the speed with which Lord Hutton was appointed. According to official event, Tony Blair was in the air, on the way from America to Japan, more than halfway there, when he was told of the Dr. Kelly's body being found. This is the official version. He then spoke to Lord Falconer, the relevant minister, and to Alistair Campbell. It was decided that there ought to be an inquiry into Dr. Kelly's death. It was concluded that Lord Hutton would be the appropriate person to chair that. It was necessary to sound out the master of the rolls to see whether he was in agreement with that. It was then necessary for Lord Falconer to go to visit Lord Hutton to discuss the matter with him, at which the terms of reference would be agreed. Lord Hutton then had to agree the terms of reference and mull over the matter. He then had to agree. Lord Falconer had to appoint him, and it had to be reported back to the master of the rolls and to Tony Blair. And you know what? All this happened before Tony Blair actually landed in Japan. Astonishing speed with which the government can act when it wants to do so. But of course, what that did mean was that when the stories in the papers were written that day, they were written about the establishment of an inquiry, not about the circumstances surrounding David Kelly's death. A very convenient change of direction. Now, in this country, if you believe in the rule of law, we have something called a coroner's inquest. And when somebody suffers an unexplained or violent death, there is an inquest. That inquest is established under proper procedures, long-established proper procedures, at which, for example, people give evidence under oath, they can be subpoenaed to attend, and the normal safeguards of a court procedure will apply. The rules of cross-examination, for example, and the hurdles required to reach verdicts. For example, in a coroner's inquest, you have to be convinced beyond reasonable doubt, that's the hurdle, before you can bring in a suicide verdict. Beyond reasonable doubt. I just wind you back for the last 10 minutes and ask you whether you think this is beyond reasonable doubt in this case. But of course, we didn't have a coroner's inquest because the Oxfordshire coroner, Nicholas Gardiner, began to look at the matter, as indeed he would, it was within his bailiwick, within his jurisdiction. But then what happened? Lord Falconer, a government minister, who'd been in touch with Tony Blair, of course, about Lord Hutton's appointment, told the Oxfordshire coroner he was being replaced in this matter by Lord Hutton. But the Oxfordshire coroner said, well, I'd like to carry on a bit further. But then Lord Falconer wrote to him and said, I'm bundling you off the case. You must stop your work now. And I've got those details. I've got those letters because Harriet Harman very helpfully released them to me under the Freedom of Information Act. So we know what Lord Falconer wrote to the Oxfordshire coroner. It's all there in black and white. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not particularly comfortable with a government minister telling a coroner to get off the case when it's a significant death like this. But that's what happened on this particular occasion. And Lord Hutton was appointed. And Lord Hutton was appointed under the Coroner's Act 1988 under a provision which has been not very often used. Now, that provision was brought in by the then Conservative government for actually quite a sensible reason. Because when you have a situation such as, say, a train crash, and you have multiple deaths, all of which have the same cause, then it's actually more efficient and less heartrending for the individuals involved, the family members and so on, if the matter can be dealt with as one inquiry rather than having a series of repetitive inquests. So that provision was brought in to deal with that situation. On every occasion, there haven't been very many, it's been four or five, on every occasion since then when that provision has been used, there have been multiple deaths, except for David Kelly. And on every occasion when that's been used, the coroner's inquest has been replaced by another statutory process, such as the 1921 Tribunals Act, with the same legal safeguards, except in the case of David Kelly. And what we have with David Kelly was a non-statutory inquiry with as much legal formality as my talk to you here today. No more, no less than that. So Lord Hutton didn't have the ability to summon witnesses. He wasn't required to summon witnesses. There were key witnesses who didn't attend. Mai Pedersen, who told us about David Kelly's aversion to swallowing tablets, who had information about his state of mind being his closest friend, who knew that he damaged his elbow and couldn't cut with a knife shortly before he died. Thames Valley Police told Lord Hutton she'd nothing of interest to tell him. So she wasn't called to give evidence. The police officer in charge of the inquiry, Alan Young, wasn't asked to give evidence. He didn't appear at the Hutton inquiry. He wasn't even mentioned. I found out afterwards he was a man in charge. We didn't even know he was there. Didn't know he existed until then. And other key people weren't invited to attend either. So we had a partial inquiry in terms of those who turned up. We had an inquiry where there was no proper cross-examination, as demonstrated by some of the many loose ends which had been left hanging. And we had a so-called inquiry where people were not under oath, they could not be subpoenaed, they could, if they wished to, lie with impunity. That is not a satisfactory way to deal with perhaps the most controversial and sensational death of this century, but that is what happened. And in addition to that, as I've mentioned earlier, Lord Hutton, in fact, spent relatively little time on David Kelly and a great deal more time on the BBC. That is a disgrace of a process and needs to be remedied. Now, there's one more thing about the coroner, because the coroner was effectively told that he did a one last duty, which was to issue a death certificate. So he issued a death certificate which gave the reasons for death as incision of the ulnar artery and ingestion of coproximal tablets and potentially a complementary cause related to hardening the arteries or some heart condition, which, by the way, had not been picked up when David Kelly had had a medical shortly beforehand and it was unknown to his GP. That certificate was issued, I think, on the 14th of August 2003. Lord Hutton's inquiry had been in place for less than a week, and none of the evidence relating to David Kelly had been heard. So one might conclude, what was the point of Lord Hutton's inquiry if the death certificate had already established the cause of death? One might also conclude, what was the point of asking the coroner to issue the death certificate if Lord Hutton was about to look into the matter? Either way, that cannot be squared as a process. And I would suggest to you that the conclusion that Lord Hutton reached in his ludicrous and informal inquiry is, in legal terms, unsafe and cannot be sustained. So I'm in no doubt at the end of that, looking into all that, and I've only, frankly, touched the surface and with the matter. So there's a lot more detail in here, which is even more, I hope, compelling I concluded at the end of that that there was no other conclusion that could be reached than that I had been murdered. It clearly wasn't suicide for the reasons I've given. It clearly wasn't a natural cause, and it clearly wasn't an accident. So that's the only explanation which you're left with. Now, that's a very uncomfortable conclusion to reach. It's also a rather dangerous conclusion to reach for someone who's a Member of Parliament, because it's outside the normal comfort zone which we operate in. Although many of my colleagues will tell me sotto voce they agree with me, they don't want to come out and say so very much publicly. It's a dangerous place to be in terms of political credibility. But I have to go with where the facts are. You can't disavow the facts. They are as they are. I then went on to look into who might have caused David Kelly's death and for what reason. And that was much more difficult, obviously. If you find somebody metaphorically with a knife in their back, it's not difficult to conclude they've been murdered. It's much more difficult to establish who's done it. My investigations took me into contact with members connected with the security services, both in this country and America, with UN weapons inspectors, with people in his own community, in his own village, with others who had something to say. And my Mail on Sunday article, which I referred to, had in fact generated about 30 responses, specifically providing new leads or new information about David Kelly's circumstances, which was useful to be able to take forward. There isn't an obvious person or body responsible. Now, I've, in my book, gone through and identified what I think happened. And I think the key to understanding what happened is to ask why it is that he was found as he was in Harrowdown Hill. If you accept, as I hope you do, that he did not inflict those wounds upon himself and that they were not the cause of death, then the key question is why those wounds were inflicted, why it was that the ulnar artery was cut, why it was that the impression was given that he had committed suicide, why was it a strange death. And the only logical answer to that is that it was an attempt to make a murder look like suicide. That's the logical explanation for that. And as someone in the KGB once said, any idiot can commit a murder. It takes an artist to commit a suicide. And I think there's some evidence of that there. Why would you do that? Well, the book goes into some detail as to who might have been responsible and dismisses those theories. For example, I don't think it was in the interest of the government of the day to have Dr. Kelly killed. I don't rule out that possibility, that governments do behave in that way on occasions. I spoke in part of my inquiry to Wouter Bassin. Wouter Bassin is, as you may or may not know, the man who was engaged by the apartheid regime in South Africa to develop weapons, first of all, to be able to kill people without it being detected, and particularly to be able to kill black people and not kill white people. That was his task. He had a lot of money and resources to enable him to do that. If you want to read about it, it's all there in the Truth and Reconciliation hearing, which have been published in open session by the South Africans as a result of what Nelson Mandela put in place around the turn of the century. I spoke to Wouter Bassin. His view was that, first of all, he knew David Kelly and said he wouldn't commit suicide, but he also said to me, if you think Western governments don't have the capacity to commit assassinations, then you're naive. You know, I'll leave that with you. You can make up your own mind about that. But there was no obvious political motive for Tony Blair and his colleagues, whatever else they did, to have been responsible for David Kelly's death. It caused a storm for them, which may have led to the downfall of the government. So it's difficult to see what motive they would have had in that matter. Others may have had other motives, and I go through that in the book, and I explain to you in there why I've reached a conclusion which I have. I'm conscious of the time, and also I want to bring some people in for questions, so let me stop there. But let me just say what I want out of this process and why I'm doing it. I want three things. First of all, I want a coroner's inquest. I've indicated in my book what I think happened. I've indicated why the conclusions Lord Hutton has reached are wrong, but I don't pretend that I'm a replacement for a proper legal process. I'm not. But I think there should be a proper legal process. I think if we don't stick to that basis in law, then it's a very dangerous road we go down. so there should be a proper coroner's inquest. Secondly, we need a proper and full inquiry into the Iraq war. I hope that John Chilcot will provide that, and I'm certainly more hopeful, having spoken to him, that he might be get somewhere nearer it than Lord Hutton did. But we need to bring to book those who lied to us, including our Prime Minister, he can sue me if he wants, who lied to us in 2003 about what was the position regarding Iraq. Those people need to be brought to book. And thirdly, I think given what David Kelly did to make the world a safer place and the service he did to this country and to the world, it would not be inappropriate if there were some posthumous recognition of his work on this planet. It is perhaps ironic that when he was found, which, by the way, I forgot to mention, was just after Parliament had gone to recess for a number of months, so we couldn't ask any questions about it, when he was found dead in the woods in a rather sad way, Tony Blair was receiving 17 standing ovations from the US Congress for giving some sort of moral justification to George Bush's illegal war in Iraq. One can't help thinking that there's something rather unjust about that comparison. I would like to see David Kelly recognized for the work he did, because while Blair and Bush were causing wars, David Kelly had actually done quite a lot to avoid them. He was the one who had taken away the weapons of mass destruction, not Blair and Bush, and I think that should be recognized.
Now, we continue with an interview with Dr. David Halpin, who, as a retired surgeon, observed what was claimed about Dr. David Kelly's death and said that that made no sense at all based on his experience as a doctor, and with a group of other doctors and a coroner formed a legal opposition to the David Kelly case and tried to challenge that in the High Court. And this is an interview after the UK government's decision to refuse to reopen the inquest into Dr. David Kelly's death. It's from December 2011.
I was told to expect failure, all right? So I'm not weeping. I might weep later. But nothing has changed. You don't bleed to death from cutting the ulnar artery in your wrist. That, as a surgeon, many surgeons will tell you, doesn't happen. That's what was said to have happened to Dr. Kelly. The other thing which hasn't changed is there's still no inquest. Do you understand me? There was no inquest worth its salt 8 years ago, well, 8.5 years ago, and there's been no inquest today. All they've done is to refuse an inquest, all right? So the facts haven't changed. What we've been trying to do is to uphold the laws of our country. And I'm afraid the laws of our country have been trampled in this case because Dr. Kelly is unique for several decades at least in not having had a proper inquest for his unnatural death. Do you understand me? He didn't die of pneumonia. He died, we found him in a wood with a cut in his wrist and some empty packets of pills alongside. The thing is, the law that we saw today, or we were subjected to, was quite arcane. It was quite complicated, really. And but you have to keep saying, what's it about? And what it's about is that there was a man died unnaturally, as I've said, and a Lord Chancellor, who also had another post, he was Secretary of State for Constitutional Affairs, he decided, whilst within a few hours of Dr. Kelly's body being found, he decided to have an informal inquiry, an inquiry without an oath. That's an ad hoc inquiry. Added another thing later, called 17A. We can discuss that as well. Not enough time. But the thing is that he did it. The alacrity that Lord Falconer applied to this case was extraordinary. Consider the Chilcot inquiry, I call it the conversation because it has no law, nothing will happen. That started 6.5 years after they first started killing people in Iraq. 6.5 years. Kelly's inquiry, or at least the appointment of it, happened the morning his body was found. Worked that one out. Well, we know why it was done like that, because Falconer wanted to contain the inquiry. so that everything was filtered, do you see? So the police didn't come forward with evidence saying there were no fingerprints on the knife, their fingerprints on the spectacles, no DNA or something. A lot of evidence was retained. And you say, why was it retained? If it was an inquest for with suicide, these things would have come forward. We've had to prise these facts out one by one, particularly a man called Miles Goslett, a journalist, freelance journalist, and he has, through freedom of information requests, got these things out. It was mentioned today, but not in the right context, you see. What we heard today was a small part of what you would get at an inquest. If there was inquest, it would run for about 6-7 weeks on this man, and then the country would know his death was properly investigated. At the moment, it hasn't been investigated at all, whatever you're told.
The government will certainly be hoping this is the end of the matter.
No, it's not. No. I can tell you there are millions of people in this country who were shocked by his death and remain certain that they haven't heard the whole story. I'm not saying that he was murdered. Maybe he was a suicide. But what we do know is the inquiry was insufficient.
I get the impression you believe it was a lot deeper than just...
I do. The story about him being the source, he wasn't the source anyway of this sexing up. We all knew the dossier was sexed up to justify the Iraq war. Millions of people knew that in this country. So that was a known, do you see? So it wasn't as if that was any great secret. But if you look at the... it is complicated, really, but he had access to a lot of information. He had five hard drives in his house with encrypted, apparently. They were removed by the police after he was found dead. And I feel he would have known what was being used in Iraq. And if you look at my website, the website of David Halpin, and you look at an essay I wrote, which was Tony Blair... My favorite person. That wasn't the title. Tony Blair, Questions Before Charge. If you look down the bottom of the essay, you will see some pictures. There's a picture of a lady in Palestine who's got shrapnel in her tummy, died. And there's a picture of a boy called Ali Abbas, whose arms were burned off, incinerated. So he's armless. He's back in Baghdad now. And that boy, Ali Abbas, his arms were incinerated by I don't know what it was exactly, but it was some type of nuclear weapon. Right. 10 days from when the bombardment started. Ali Abbas, his mum and dad and 10 relatives were incinerated in the same house that night. There's no weapon I know about which can cause that, which is conventional. And I think that Dr. Kelly might have known about this. You see what I mean?
What kind of weapons?
Well, I think that don't ever believe that we don't use some pretty vile weapons. You know, what is a weapon of mass destruction? 1,000-kilogram bombs. Where they're now talking about using nuclear-tipped bunker busters in Iran. You see? So I think Kelly might have known that. I don't know, but he was a very intelligent man, a conscientious man, I think, and I would suspect that he knew something. That this is, of course, assuming that there was foul play. We don't know that. What we need is a proper inquest. I was born in 1940. I was the eldest of four children. My sister, who's the second one down the line, was here today supporting me and supporting this country. I'm a patriot, so is she, so millions of others. And we want a country to be truthful and not to be corrupt. This country is corrupt at the top and for a long way down, you know? To lie, when I was a little one, to lie was a cardinal sin. So when I see untruthfulness, when I see a lie, I have to react. And I cannot stand lies. Hate lies. And this is why I've stuck with it. And I know this is a lie, this case, you see. Not necessarily. He may have taken his life. I think it's unlikely. The thing is, it hasn't been inquired into properly. So it's a lie. If people are quiet in the face of untruthfulness, then they are lying with it. Silence is complicity. So that's what it really is, my upbringing, which I think was quite common in the war years and just afterwards, Second World War. We were taught to be truthful. And this isn't truthful. We are, as I say, in this country, mired, that's in the bog, mired in mendacity, in lies. There's lots of lies. PR is lies. In that House of Commons down the way, there's lots of lies. On that piece of paper, I'll say this, actually, I'll just repeat it to you. It's, in fact, a nice little statement I wrote yesterday afternoon, and it says, "Hold this in your hearts. John Locke, who was the leader of the Enlightenment in Britain, said this in 1675, and I wish John Locke was here today. He said, where the law ends, tyranny begins. And that sounds rather heavy, but in the spring, in the House of Commons, they bundled in an act called the Geneva Conventions Act, 1957. They bundled it in with another act, the Police and Order Act or something, and this is at the request of Israel. I see you nod. Miss Livni and other people had lobbied the parliamentarians of both sides, Labour and Conservative. They'd lobbied them to remove this act or to emasculate it. And it's emasculated. So the last person that they tried to question here under this act was Doron Almog. I was involved with it, actually, with a very good solicitor called Makova. And they managed, they've emasculated it now. They have to go to the Director of Public Prosecutions with to seek a warrant. But by the time they've done all that, they're on the phone and they've flown off wherever they're going to. Do you understand me? So you see what I mean, you see? That's exactly true. Where the law ends, tyranny begins. They've removed the law, and in that, we now know that war criminals can be walking along here without any chance at all, really, really, that they will be apprehended and brought to book. So our world becomes more lawless, not just our country. So that's what I'm standing up for, is the law. We tried it today, a bit arcane, very tricky, pretty expensive. We haven't won, but nothing has changed with Dr. Kelly. His death remains improperly investigated. And as I said before, you don't bleed to death from a cut on an artery. That's manifest rubbish, as another surgeon told me.
And that interview was by Hassan Khani of Press TV UK. That's an Iranian-backed TV channel which was banned in the UK. We continue with another Press TV contribution. This is a documentary entitled The Death of Dr. Kelly, An Open Case, and it's from January 2013.
On the 20th of March 2003, US and British forces invaded Iraq under the pretense of destroying weapons of mass destruction. In 2009, the Iraq Inquiry was created to examine Britain's role in Iraq. Seen by many commentators as a marshalled and well-orchestrated production, the inquiry, led by Chairman Sir John Chilcot, was met with mixed responses by the public.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Sir John Chilcot, and I'm the chairman of the Iraq Inquiry.
In the months leading up to the attack, British Prime Minister Tony Blair perpetuated a lie about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in a bid to manufacture consent for the war. The Blair government claimed that Iraq had weapons capable of striking Britain within 45 minutes. It emerged later that this claim about Iraq's capabilities had been denied by a prominent British weapons scientist, Dr. David Kelly, during meetings with reporters. A few weeks later, Dr. Kelly's body was found near his home in suspicious circumstances. In 1996, a plan for the invasion and occupation of Iraq was finalised in the White House by neocons Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, John Bolton, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. Richard Perle stated that the plan was to wage total war by using the US military to invade and occupy any country that opposed America's self-serving foreign policies. Perle even believed people would sing great songs about them for years. According to Bob Woodward's book, Plan of Attack, when the White House decided to accelerate their plans to invade Iraq, Blair was not consulted. Condoleezza Rice informed the British government, and it was not until the next day that Bush spoke to Blair personally and thanked him. A third source, also in a position to know. In the months leading up to the attack, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell presented misleading drawings to the United Nations about WMD in Iraq.
I believe that Iraq is now in further material breach of its obligations. I believe this conclusion is irrefutable and undeniable. Iraq has now placed itself in danger of the serious consequences called for in UN Resolution 1441.
Standing shoulder to shoulder with the Americans, British Prime Minister Tony Blair parroted the lie about WMD in a bid to manufacture consent for the war.
It is the case that if the only means of achieving the disarmament of Iraq of weapons of mass destruction is the removal of the regime, then the removal of the regime, of course, has to be our objective.
Iraq probably has no weapons of mass destruction in the commonly understood sense of the term, namely a credible device capable of being delivered against a strategic city target. It probably does still have biological toxins and battlefield chemical munitions, but it's had them since the 1980s, when US companies sold Saddam anthrax agents and the then British government approved chemical and munitions factories. Why is it now so urgent that we should take military action to disarm a military capacity that has been there for 20 years and which we helped to create? Why is it necessary to resort to war this week while Saddam's ambition to complete his weapons program is blocked by the presence of UN inspectors? Only a couple of weeks ago, Hans Blix told the Security Council that the key remaining disarmament tasks could be completed within months.
What was really important about this business of sites given was that when we reported that no, we didn't find any weapons of mass destruction, they should have realized, I think, both in London and in Washington, that their sources were poor. Both Condoleezza Rice and Prime Minister Blair, I sort of alerted to the fact that we were skeptical, and I made the remark then that I cited many times that, look, wouldn't it be paradoxical for you to invade Iraq with 250,000 men and find very little?
Well, I think what is interesting when you look back in my lifetime is when Harold Wilson was the Prime Minister of Britain in the 60s, is that the Labour government of the day did not go into Vietnam. Under enormous pressure from Lyndon Johnson, they said no. Tony Blair, for some reasons that most of us don't understand, was persuaded to go into Iraq, or I don't even think he was persuaded. He was side by side with the most right-wing, somewhat eccentric president in history in the United States. So it's still a question. I mean, the question that still isn't answered is, why did he do it? Now, Tony Blair says, because I believed it was right. Well, I'm afraid that's not enough. That's not good enough.
Why do you think the Prime Minister was ignoring the warnings you were giving and going ahead?
I think this gets to the root of why we went. And I think now you can see the leaked documents. The Americans were determined to go. Blair had said he'd go with them. He couldn't get Britain there without going through the UN. But in the end, if the Americans were going, he was determined to go with them. And I repeat, I've said it before, but it's very important. There was no need to go at that time. There was no emergency. There was nothing happening that meant we couldn't have more time.
It's often said that Mr. Blair made Britain the tail of the American dog. But I don't really myself buy that. I actually believe that the British were co-conspirators. They were co-murderers of hundreds of thousands, maybe more than a million people in Iraq, which is a crime of almost unimaginable proportions and knocks the crimes of Mr. Charles Taylor or Mr. Ratko Mladic into a cocked hat, actually. I believe that Mr. Blair was intellectually superior to Mr. Bush, that he led Mr. Bush rather than was led. The British were not deceived by the Americans. The British and the Americans in concert hatched a conspiracy to deceive the world.
The idea that we doctored such intelligence is completely and totally false. Every single piece of intelligence that we presented was cleared very properly by the Joint Intelligence Committee.
Now, 8 years on, of course, we now know that, of course, they sexed up the case for war, which is what the allegation was. Of course they did it. And I don't think I meet anybody who doesn't think they sexed up the case for war.
But the point, just to keep focused on at the moment, is that the actual quality of the intelligence...
I did believe it. I mean, that was the... And I did believe it, frankly, beyond doubt. And
beyond your doubt, but beyond anybody's doubt?
Our partners in Washington are less interested in disarmament than they are in regime change in Iraq. And that explains why any evidence that inspections may be showing progress is greeted in Washington not with satisfaction, but with consternation, because it reduces the case for war.
Did you feel that it gave Iraq a realistic possibility of meeting the requirements of the resolution?
Yes, except that it was very hard for them to declare any weapons when they didn't have any.
Hans Blix had voiced concerns about the US regime's desire for war against Iraq. He was on record as saying that Bush and Blair were exaggerating the issue in order to invade, a position he maintained in the lead-up to the war. Blix has also said that the Blair government would have liked to have gone down the diplomatic route to disarm Saddam Hussein, but became a prisoner of a US policy heading towards war. Blix faced a barrage of intense criticism from Washington and the neocons for speaking out. It was later revealed that Tony Blair had already secretly committed Britain to war in 2002, promising George W. Bush that UK forces would join the US-led invasion, come what may.
Concludes that Iraq has chemical and biological weapons, that Saddam has continued to produce them, that he has existing and active military plans for the use of chemical and biological weapons, which could be activated within 45 minutes.
This false claim about Iraq's alleged WMD was one of many contained in what came to be known as the Dodgy Dossier, a fraudulent document endorsed by Downing Street Press Secretary Alistair Campbell.
Did he tell President Bush in writing during 2002 that he would support the President if he took military action?
Alistair Campbell, Downing Street Press Secretary, 1997 to 2003.
I think that I would certainly say the tenor of the Prime Minister wrote quite a lot of notes to the President, and I would say that the tenor of them was that, as I said earlier, we share the analysis, we share the concern, we are absolutely with you in making sure that Saddam Hussein is faced up to his obligations and that Iraq is disarmed. If that can't be done diplomatically, and it has to be done militarily, Britain will be there. That would definitely be the tenor of his communications.
Claire Short, former UK Secretary of State for International Development.
This is about the special relationship. Was Blair willing to say to the Americans, I'm not going with you now, it's too early, Blix should have more time, the international system needs more time to prepare. I promised you I'd be with you, but this is the wrong time, we can take another 6 months. And I think he was so frantic to be with America that all that was thrown away. And if he'd done that, his place in history, the UK's role in the world, would have been so much more honourable. But, and this is, Britain needs to think about this, the special relationship. What do we mean by it? Do we mean that we have an independent relationship and we say what we think? Or do we mean we just abjectly go wherever America goes because we think that puts us in the big league? And I think that was it, and it's a tragedy. That is the tragedy.
On the 29th of May 2003, a story broke, questioning the Blair government's arguments for war. This would go on to send shockwaves through the British establishment. Andrew Gilligan, a BBC reporter, back in Britain from Iraq, reported live at 6:07 a.m. on BBC Radio 4's Today programme that a news source had told him that a dossier about the military capabilities of Iraq was made sexier in the week before its publication in order to support the argument for going to war with the country.
Claim in his dossier, which he published in September, the main case, if you like, against Iraq, and the main statement of the British government's belief of what it thought Iraq was up to. And what we've been told by one of the senior officials in charge of drawing up that dossier was that actually the government probably knew that that 45-minute figure was wrong even before it decided to put it in. What this person says is that a week before the publication date of the dossier, it was actually rather a bland production. It didn't the draft prepared for Mr. Blair by the intelligence agencies actually didn't say very much more than was public knowledge already. And Downing Street, our source says, ordered a week before publication, ordered it to be sexed up, to be made more exciting.
The source of this story was the UN and British Ministry of Defence Weapons Inspector, Dr. David Kelly. Eventually, it was confirmed that Dr. David Kelly had been the source for BBC journalist Andrew Gilligan's story.
He was he'd come forward to the Ministry of Defence, as he thought, in confidence. He'd been promised that his name wouldn't be revealed as the source. They'd then broken that promise. They'd outed him. They'd quite deliberately leaked, or effectively leaked, his name to the press. They gave the press a series of clues, which enabled anyone with an internet connection to guess his name. They then confirmed the name to any journalist who guessed it, and one newspaper, for instance, put more than 20 names to the Ministry of Defence press office before it confirmed David Kelly's. After the name emerged, they then pushed the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Commons to interview him, even though it had already finished its inquiry and didn't actually want to interview him.
Greg Dyke, BBC Director General, 2000 to 2004.
What happened after the war, of course, was we ran a piece on the Today programme early one morning saying that a source from within the intelligence community had had alleged that the government had fixed the case for war, that they hadn't properly scrutinised the intelligence and put it through the normal process. As a result, we ran the story. As a result, the government went ballistic. They then leaked out the name of the person they thought was our source, a Dr. David Kelly.
He was paraded on television in front of those MPs, subject to a very unpleasant experience for him. He was harangued by one of the MPs. It was called Chaff. And he was asked a number of questions about his interactions with journalists, to which he did not give totally frank answers, and I think that worried him. And the Ministry of Defence told him that they were going to investigate some of those answers.
Treating you uniquely as a civil servant, in highly publicising you before going to the Intelligence and Security Committee.
That's a conclusion you can draw.
The feeling I have, and you might be able to help me on this, is that
certainly this 45-minute claim, which came up in a British government document 6 months before the Iraq war and was repeated, I think, three times in the document, that Iraq could have its weapons of mass destruction ready within 45 minutes, which was given massive publicity in this country, he knew that wasn't true. Probably he knew a lot of other things were not true as well. But he certainly knew that wasn't true. So one day he carries on with this process of talking quietly to journalists, which he'd been encouraged to do for about 10 years. And suddenly what he says is not acceptable for once.
At that time it mattered acutely what he was saying, because he was the only person of authority, a professional person, who was evidently leaking the story that there were no, in his view, almost certainly no weapons of mass destruction. And this was before we'd invaded a neutral country, contrary to international law. So therefore, they had every reason to be worried about what he was saying. It could have removed the pretext for war. It seemed to be doing so.
On July the 17th, 2003, Dr. David Kelly was found dead in suspicious circumstances on Harrowden Hill, near his home in Oxfordshire. With Dr. Kelly's sudden demise, the government no longer had to fear what he may or may not have known, or what he may or may not have revealed to the public about the war against Iraq.
I came across him as somebody with an expertise in a field I was covering, Iraqi biological and chemical weapons. I can't exactly remember at this distance when my first meeting was or how it came about, but we had a number of one-to-one meetings. He was a good source. He'd given information which had been reliable in the past. We met up in May 2003 to talk about Iraqi things. I'd not long come back from Iraq. He was interested in that. Obviously, the war had only just finished, and we got to talking about the dossier, and he said it had been transformed to make it sexier. He said that one of the key pieces of intelligence that had underpinned the dossier was single source and wasn't regarded by him and other experts as reliable.
Individuals who are of a particular moral fibre or who are highly principled may take a view which differs from the view being expressed by government. And they may be conducible, but perhaps not if they're of such high integrity. And it may be that such people come under various pressures in order to be able to change their view. We see it as an everyday event, so far as members of parliament are concerned, that may want to vote against a government whip. There are all kinds of pressures that each of us are placed under. And undoubtedly, David Kelly had many pressures, professional, public, personal, which he had to face.
In journalist Christopher King's Redress Information and Analysis report, published on May 20, 2010, he concluded that the Blair cabal found that it had put in the public spotlight a weapons inspector of unimpeachable competence and integrity, who had sufficient knowledge and authority to destroy their entire case for war at a time when public feeling against the war was high.
Jim Brann, a spokesman for the Stop the War Coalition.
You cannot look at the Kelly case without looking at the 12 years that went before it. And really, the 12 years that went before it is itself an enormous crime. And out of it comes the Kelly case. And I think it's very striking, for example, in this country where we have a free press, as they put it, that they promoted the Iraq war on the basis of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. And then there was some kind of scandal when there were no weapons of mass destruction. But they managed to keep completely quiet the deaths of many, many people under the 12 years before that. They've just buried that question. And really, the Kelly case is part of that big scandal.
Retired surgeon Dr. David Halpin.
His death, whether by his own hand, by suicide, or whether it was in fact homicide, murder, was all to do with the Iraq war. Kelly wouldn't have been dead if there wasn't an Iraq war. And the Iraq war was founded on a pack of lies. Blair and Bush and the rest of the cabal had snatched WMD and all the rest of it from thin air as a pretext for annihilating Iraq. I'm exaggerating a little. That's what has, in effect, has happened. Iraq has been finished by this, like Galloway said, like wolves, you know, being set upon the country.
Dr. Halpin quotes me as talking about Britain and America falling on Iraq like wolves. But I later apologized to the wolves because no wolf would ever have committed such a savage and unnecessary act of mass destruction.
The legal ramifications for Tony Blair and his government were quite clear, conspiring with the US to deceive the British public and launch a war of aggression against Iraq would be a direct violation of the Nuremberg Accords and leave the Blair government open to prosecution as war criminals. The Hutton Inquiry, whose head, Lord Hutton, was appointed by the Blair regime, convened on August 12, 2003, to investigate the death of Dr. Kelly. The inquiry exonerated Tony Blair and ruled that Dr. Kelly's death was a suicide.
I am satisfied that Dr. Kelly took his own life in the wood at Herodon Hill
at a time between 4:15 p.m. on the 17th of July and 1:15 a.m. on the 18th of July 2003, and that the principal cause of death was bleeding from incised wounds to the left wrist, which Dr. Kelly inflicted on himself with the knife found beside his body.
The Hutton inquiry's findings were widely regarded by experts as a whitewash and a government cover-up. After all, Lord Hutton was appointed by the very government he was supposed to investigate, thus posing a conflict of interest.
There was an investigation done by someone called Lord Hutton, who was appointed by the government, and as one member of the government told me at the time, or told us at the time, you know, we appointed the right judge, and they did. They appointed a judge who found for them.
The inquiry that took place with Lord Hutton wasn't an inquiry that investigated all the possible angles. It took place at a time when it's quite possible that there were people who ought to have come to give evidence were not called, and those people who did come and give evidence never gave evidence on oath. And I think it's a big failing that there hasn't been an inquiry like an inquest where a coroner could call particular people to attend and insist that they're there, and when they come, ask them to give evidence on oath.
So I felt uncomfortable about the level of the investigation into the circumstances of death, and I felt extremely uncomfortable as a doctor, and indeed I have never spoken to another doctor who has done anything other than agree with me that it's highly improbable that anyone would ever die from hemorrhage as a consequence of the severance of the smaller of the two arteries in the left wrist.
As the curtain came down on the Hutton inquiry, an epic sequel was already in the works, as crowds and players alike rolled up for the Iraq inquiry. British Ministry of Defence weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly was found dead in suspicious circumstances in 2003, after he was revealed as the source in an investigation that dismantled the government's lies about Iraqi WMD and the case for war. The controversial Hutton inquiry, set up to investigate Dr. Kelly's demise, was seen by many as an extension of the government's cover-up, and as more evidence came to light, it soon became clear that the death of Dr. David Kelly was still an open case. Another important aspect of the story is how the media covered these events. The BBC especially was criticised by many experts for their coverage of the Hutton inquiry, the death of Dr. Kelly, the issue of WMD in Iraq, and the subsequent war.
My research found that the BBC, from the beginning, has been particularly cautious in the way that it's covered this issue. One could perhaps argue, understandably, given the kind of pressure that the BBC was under at the time and ever since. But I would argue that that kind of caution is exactly what we don't want from our public service broadcaster, exactly what the public does not expect from the BBC.
The intelligence community remains convinced weapons of mass destruction will be found in Iraq. Only then will all the doubts go away. Gavin Hewitt, BBC News.
The BBC is as much of a state information bureau as many of the state information bureau that they routinely condemn. This is, if you like, in the DNA of the BBC, that it requires to please its political masters. And in the aftermath of the Iraq war, we saw this in all its ugliness, the way in which the then Blair government was able to completely defenestrate the leadership of the BBC, getting rid of the chairman of the Board of Governors, as they then were, getting rid of the Director General, as he then was, Greg Dyke.
I don't think the media itself caused the war. I mean, the war was caused by George Bush, who wanted to go to war, and Tony Blair, who decided to support him. But without media on side, I think, or without some of the media on side, I think Tony Blair would have had great difficulty getting the decision to go to war through the Houses of Parliament.
In reaction to the widespread criticism and pressure from the public on one hand and the government on the other, the BBC issued a statement on the 28th of January 2004. The statement reads, "The BBC does accept that certain key allegations reported by Andrew Gilligan on the Today programme on May the 29th last year were wrong, and we apologise for them. We would point out again that at no stage in the last 8 months have we accused the Prime Minister of lying, and have said this publicly on several occasions. Although some groups are vocal in rejecting the ruling that this was a suicide, not everyone finds fault with Hutton's verdict."
And essentially, the 45-minute point was probably the most important thing that was added, and the reason it hadn't been in the original draft was that it only came from one source, and most of the other claims came from two. And the intelligence agencies say they don't believe it was necessarily true because they thought the person making the claim had actually made a mistake.
A lot of the things which seem superficially suspicious about his death actually have perfectly plausible explanations. The relative lack of blood has been described by a group of doctors the other week as suspicious. They say he couldn't have died from cutting as he did the ulnar artery, which is a small artery that closes up when it's cut. Now, that may or may not be true. And in fact, the pathologist who did the original post-mortem has been in the papers this week saying there was actually quite a lot of blood and he could easily have bled to death from the ulnar artery alone. However, the cut to the ulnar artery was only one cause of death. The full cause of death is a combination of that with two other things: the fact that his long-standing heart condition and the fact that he swallowed 29 coproximal tablets, a powerful painkilling tablet. And a lot of pathologists have said that the combination of those three things, the interaction of them, is a totally and perfectly plausible cause of death.
Because of the interest in the political issues that formed the backdrop to Dr. Kelly's death, a significant number of people have raised concerns about his death and the process used to investigate it, and have called for a new inquest to be set up. At this stage, only the High Court can order an inquest, and then only on an application made by me or by another with my consent. I was asked last year to make such an application, and have since then been provided with a large amount of information which is said to support the case for an inquest. Mr. Speaker, having given all the material that's been sent to me the most careful consideration, I have concluded that the evidence that Dr. Kelly took his own life is overwhelmingly strong. Further, there is nothing I've seen that supports any allegation that Dr. Kelly was murdered or that his death was the subject of any kind of conspiracy or cover-up.
I have never been a conspiracy theorist, and I think it's quite difficult to see who would have wanted Dr. Kelly dead. Certainly with the security services wouldn't have wanted him dead. But I think if you go back to the whole of the Hutton inquiry and what it looked at, I mean, the inquiry itself was quite interesting. The only trouble is Lord Hutton drew conclusions that no sane person could have drawn.
The central reason why I do not believe he was murdered is that I cannot see in whose interest it would have been to murder him. I mean, if you think about it, it could not possibly have been in the British government's interest to murder him, because his death plunged them into a huge crisis, a crisis from which they never really recovered. And anyone with an iota of sense in Whitehall would have known that killing him would create such a crisis.
Challenging the verdict, anesthesiology specialist Dr. Searle Sennett, diagnostic radiology specialist Dr. Stephen Frost, Dr. Christopher Burns Cox, Dr. Andrew Rouse, and retired surgeon Dr. David Halpin submitted evidence to the Attorney General in 2011. They were applying for a new inquiry into Kelly's death. We interviewed Dr. Halpin in December 2011 after the court refused their request.
You don't bleed to death from cutting the ulnar artery in your wrist. That, as a surgeon, many surgeons will tell you, doesn't happen. That's what was said to have happened to Dr. Kelly. The other thing which hasn't changed is there's still no inquest. Do you understand me?
Yes.
There was no inquest worth its salt 8 years ago, or 8.5 years ago, and there's been no inquest today.
Edward Mint and Mary Cheatham are local citizens of Farringdon in Oxfordshire, where David Kelly died. They, like many others, are dismayed by the refusal to hold an inquest.
I just can't believe that when David Halpin made this application to the Attorney General for a judicial review, that how Grieve could say there was no justification for reopening the inquiry or having an inquest. I would have thought there is loads of things to be answered. And then we have the coroner at the time, Nicholas Gardner, saying he was sort of lent on. There was no suggestion that he should not hold an inquest. Far too many things are completely wrong with the whole business.
At first, we didn't take an awful lot of notice because it seemed to go... Everybody said that Dr. Kelly had committed suicide. Right from the start, it was assumed that. Of course, very nicely for the powers that be. But then we began to query the whole thing. And I actually bought 4 copies of Norman Baker's book, and I've passed them around my friends and anybody who was interested. And I think they too have become convinced that Dr. Kelly was murdered.
In May 2006, former Lib Dem MP Norman Baker resigned from the Shadow Cabinet to pursue an investigation into the alleged murder of Dr. David Kelly. In his book, The Strange Death of David Kelly, he writes, "I believe there are enough doubts, enough questions, enough of a smell of stinking fish to justify reopening this episode officially. As far as the government's actions are concerned, we need a full and independent inquiry into the events that led us into war, and those that followed in the years after, when British troops were in Iraq. As far as Dr. Kelly is concerned, we owe it to a good man to set aside the face of a process that occurred and create a new process that inspires public confidence and examines this matter officially, openly and honestly, and with the rigour that the people of this country are entitled to expect." Experts maintain that the Hutton Inquiry's findings retain little to no credibility in light of evidence surrounding Dr. Kelly's death. Lord Hutton refused to call the head of the Thames Valley Police Investigation, Alan Young, to give evidence. The South Central Ambulance NHS Trust claims to have lost the patient report form completed by paramedic Vanessa Hunt at the scene of Dr. Kelly's death. And Dr. Kelly's death certificate does not state a place of death.
We thought there would have been more blood over the body if someone bled to death.
What sort of experience have you got in going to attempted suicides and where people have indeed slashed their wrist?
Well, everyone that works for the ambulance service has been to that type of injury. And yes, there's usually more blood around.
Do people normally die from that sort of injury?
I've never been to one that's died yet.
You've been to a number of them?
Yeah.
A good example is the evidence that the police had gathered. You know, the journalist Miles Goslett and others, Baker, Norman Baker the MP, another journalist, Garrick Older, through Freedom of Information requests, have got out very important evidence which should have been put before the Hutton Inquiry. It was withheld from the Hutton Inquiry. One of the key things is that there were no fingerprints on the handle of the knife.
The Thames Valley Police had conducted a series of tests on items found with Dr. Kelly's body, and they'd searched for fingerprints and DNA evidence, and they'd found that in fact there were no fingerprints on any of the items found with his body. Personal items like his glasses, his wallet, keys, his watch, none of these things had any fingerprints on them. And what's curious, of course, is not just that there were no fingerprints on any of these items, but that this fact was never raised at the Hutton Inquiry. Nobody ever asked the police who gave evidence to the inquiry about that. And so, of course, you have to wonder whether an active decision was taken not to raise this.
Now, I can imagine, as a doctor, what Kelly would have been, his physical state would have been like, what his mental state was like, perhaps, as he was sat there wishing, you know, gathering courage to kill himself. He would have been sweating. That's part of the fingerprint. The reason why fingerprints happen is sweat on the papillary ridges. To find a fingerprint on a knife is extraordinary. So the police who were involved with this case would have wished, I would have thought, to bring forward to Hutton that there were no fingerprints on the knife. And yet, throughout the Hutton inquiry, people, and Hutton himself says, you found no evidence of third-party involvement, he said several times. Well, the thing is that if one was in the court, he said, I'm sorry, excuse me, sir, there were no fingerprints on the knife. How do you account for that? He wasn't wearing gloves, you see? So if you just look at that and see that this has not come properly into the public domain, it must come before our law. If we pretend we live in a democracy.
Why on earth should Dr. Kelly, who knew so much about death, have attempted to commit suicide by just severing the smaller of the two arteries in one wrist? That is really quite astonishing. So I think for reasons such as that, and also the number of tablets that were taken, a big issue over how many tablets were taken, how many were ingested, the levels were not remarkable in the blood, they weren't lethal in the blood, that those matters should have been properly investigated.
So to silence him, I think, could very easily have appeared a necessary act at the time. And of course we must always remember too that people don't always behave totally rationally. One might say it was a silly action as well as wicked if it happened. But people don't, governments are not that wise always.
It's very striking that none of the police who gave evidence to Hutton were asked about those fingerprint searches. Therefore, they never had to say that the searches had been made and that they'd drawn a blank on every single score. You have to wonder why on earth this information didn't ever come out before. It only came out because several people made, myself included, a series of Freedom of Information requests to Thames Valley Police about that. One can only conclude that somebody somewhere took an active decision not to ask about the fingerprint searches which had been done. Highly irregular, very odd, very unusual, and it is one of the most striking questions which remains unanswered in the whole case.
Some experts agree that the coroner had a duty to conduct an inquest and that he has failed to do so. They accuse the government of facilitating malpractice and corruption at every level in this process. Dr. Watts and Spencer's executive summary, taken from their inquest application to the Attorney General, cites the contradictions and implausible nature of the government-approved version of events. At 9:15 a.m. on the 18th of July 2003, the body of Dr. Kelly was found with his head and shoulders against a tree. Around an hour later, the head was at some distance from the tree, sufficient for an ambulance man to stand between the tree and the head. We conclude that one or more third parties were present at the scene at Harrowden Hill and moved the body. We conclude that the likely purpose of moving the body was to create a false impression of suicide in order to conceal the murder of Dr. Kelly. We conclude that the suicide conclusion of the Hutton inquiry is unsafe and untrue. In the interest of justice, an inquest is required into the suspicious death of Dr. David Kelly. The death of Dr. David Kelly continues to haunt the political landscape. Strong public sentiments remain regarding both the Iraq War, how that war began, and the alleged assassination of Dr. David Kelly. This anger is what fuels the calls for a new inquiry.
I don't have a personal view as to exactly what occurred, but I do feel that we haven't yet had a proper exploration of all the facts, even the facts that are known, let alone those that haven't yet been brought to light. And I think there would be more to come to light if the proper people were interviewed.
The medical contradictions and improprieties did not receive the media attention revelations of this magnitude require. This possible self-censorship saw many journalists simply overlook the glaring inaccuracies of the government-approved story. In his report on the failure of the mainstream media, analyst Justin Schlossberg suggests that it was the adherence to a general consensus, a so-called safe zone of news, that led to journalistic blunders and oversights. Schlossberg's investigation also throws light onto the worrying trend by many corporate media outlets of simply accepting the official version of events without question or any form of adequate investigation.
There's very telling use of particular language and particular frames, both in the introductions and the conclusions to the report, that if you look closely at them, very much stray from the impartiality doctrine that television broadcasters tend to adopt in this country, and very much were strongly suggestive that any idea or that the campaign to reopen an inquest was based on false pretenses, that that ultimately the official verdict was safe, that the government had opened the gates of secrecy and published all the documentary evidence which campaigners had demanded be published, which was completely factually inaccurate.
The war against Iraq, coupled with the desecration of the rule of law at home and the unsolved death of Dr. Kelly, has damaged the public trust in government to a great extent. The fact that numerous British governments have blocked an inquest into Dr. Kelly's death whilst imposing draconian laws to curtail freedom of speech and dissent points to a bleak and self-defeating strategy. Public interest in solving the case of Dr. Kelly has not abated in the years since his death.
I think it's sensitive. I think you have to make a distinction between those things that people are actually going to do something about and those things that simply bother people. And in that sense, it's the second category. It bothers people. It worries people. Remember that we had, for example, the largest demonstration in British history by a long way ahead of the Iraq War. We say in the anti-war movement, we say it was 2 million people. Nobody knows. But the point is that there are hundreds of thousands of people out there who did what they have never done before in their life, which is to march in the street.
This issue has actually, if anything, has grown in terms of capturing the attention of campaigners and of the news media themselves, who initially paid virtually no attention at all to the problems surrounding the official verdict of Kelly's death, as did the Hunt report itself largely overlook that issue.
So when, for example, some news item comes up about David Kelly, or some doctors report on it, or ambulance workers or whatever, then there is a definite level of interest. It's not some story that the media are just interested in. There's clearly the media interest corresponds to a public interest as well.
The Iraq Inquiry, chaired by Sir John Chilcot, was dismayed by many as a nonsensical bit of political theatre, toothless posturing which sought to examine Britain's role in Iraq. The inquiry had no legal authority or power to enforce any conclusions it may have reached, and some even went so far as to suggest it was merely a stage for former Prime Minister Tony Blair to regurgitate his line on the Iraq War.
The truth in the end does come out, and however much it costs and however many years it takes, I believe the same will be true of the Iraq story and the attendant associated story of what happened to David Kelly.
Dr. Stephen Frost, one of the experts leading the call for a fresh inquest, stated that every medical student is taught that the coroner's duty is to speak for the dead to protect the living, and without coroners and inquests, nobody is safe.
I was taught that to lie was a cardinal sin. I hate liars. I love my country. and I do not want to see my country wallowing in lies which are never resolved. A catharsis is required, and Kelly will be part of that catharsis.
Many programmes have been made about the war in Iraq and the way the UK and the US justified it. The Iraq Inquiry is yet to officially release its report, so it may offer some closure. But it is nearly 9 years since Dr. Kelly died, and despite continuing interest in his death and vocal denouncements of the Hutton Inquiry, no further inquest or inquiry is planned. The suspicious death of Dr. Kelly still haunts many people, as they feel it is still unsolved. This is a case which is still open.
Now, we conclude the show with the following recording. This is from December 2013 from Tony Gosling's BCFM Weekly Politics show on Bristol Community Radio. The main speaker is old Labour economist Martin Summers, and it is the most speculative of the contributions we have this week. I make no apology for that. I think it will work quite well as an antidote in case you're tempted to simplistic thinking about just why David Kelly might have been murdered by forces within the UK establishment.
One of the first people, if not the first person, to sign the Book of Condolence at the South African Embassy in Trafalgar Square was David Cameron. But it's interesting to see that he had a freebie trip to apartheid South Africa right at the height of the ban, really. I mean, he admitted his party had got it wrong, though, over sanctions when he later visited Mandela. David Cameron accepted an all-expenses-paid trip to apartheid South Africa while Nelson Mandela was still in prison. An updated biography of the Tory leader reveals today a trip by Mr. Cameron in 1989, when he was a rising star of the Conservative Research Department, was a chance for him to see for himself and was funded by a firm that lobbied against the imposition of sanctions on the apartheid regime. Critics described it as a sanction-busting jolly that raised questions about the character of the man who, after a week when the government's credibility on the economy hit a new low, this is back in April 2009, was on course to be Prime Minister in a little more than a year's time.
Yeah, that trip in 1989 is quite interesting because two other people were on that trip. One was Sir Kenneth Warren, who most people won't have heard of, but he's a rather important fundraiser for the Conservative Party and has been for many years, a sort of a money man. And the other third person on that trip was Dr. David Kelly. And the purpose of the trip was to go to arms
this
corps.
This is the government scientist who died in 2003 one. In
the very same one. So there were three people on this delegation: Dr. David Kelly, Sir Kenneth Warren, and David Cameron, who is a 20-something from Conservative Central Office. And information we've been receiving suggests that there was a deal being cooked up. South Africa had 9 nuclear weapons. They originally had 10 nuclear weapons, which they developed at Pelindaba with the Israelis. One of them was exploded over the South Atlantic. That left 9 nuclear weapons. It's like 10 green bottles, isn't it, this story? Anyway, as the changes were about to take place in South Africa, the Magnus Malan, who was the Defence Minister, Arms Corps, which was the their equivalent of BAE Systems, and they basically went to the West via an intermediary called John Bradenkamp, who was an ex-Rhodesian SAS operative, but was now actually a major arms dealer. People can look him up on the internet and they will find him. He actually lives in Kilmersdown in Somerset now. But basically they did a deal. They said, we don't want Nelson Mandela and the ANC to have these 9 nuclear warheads.
This is actually the white South African government saying that, well, since the country's going over to black majority rule, we think that they shouldn't have access to these secret nuclear weapons we've got.
Yeah, because otherwise Nelson Mandela would have got his finger on the nuclear button as soon as he won the election. That wasn't acceptable to the white South African elite, and it wasn't acceptable to the Western powers either. So they did a deal whereby these 9 nuclear warheads, which were uranium-based nuclear warheads, were sold to the Western powers, 6 to the Americans and 3 to the British. But what happened, the American warheads were loaded at Durban and taken to the US and dismantled. The 3 British warheads, and this is what the delegation, we suspect this delegation was about, they weren't sold to the British government directly. a private company called Astra Holdings, which was actually a subsidiary of Astra Fireworks, if people remember them. Set up by a chap called Stephen Koch, who used to be an MI6 officer. They bought the three warheads, as it were, on the black market from Arms Corps, and then sold them on to the British government for £50 million. And Margaret Thatcher, one of the last things she did as she left office was sign a payment order for £50 million to Astra Holdings for these three warheads. But the warheads, of course, they had bought them from the South African government at much less than £50 million. And those who were involved in this scam got basically a profit from it, including the Conservative Party itself, which made £17.8 million to fund the 1992 general election.
Now, it's a pretty shocking accusation, Martin. Also, well, I've made people it before, can find it. You know. People can find it online. It's an article by Peter Eyre. It's probably the best one to find. You can find EYRE on his own blog or on the Palestine Telegraph website about this whole story. But what evidence have you got for it?
Well, I'm getting evidence from people who were involved. So they're talking to me. I can't say who because they've signed the Official Secrets Act. But in any case, as you say, if people want to check this story for themselves, they can find it on Palestine Telegraph or Peter Ayres.
I mean, this £17 million donation, for example, is there any evidence for that?
Yes, there is. Doug Hoyle, the Labour MP, had been tipped off about this, and he made a question in the House of Commons. I can't remember what the year was. It was in the 1990s. Saying, well, where did this £17.8 million come from? And there was a sort of bluff, we can't possibly tell you, you'll have to look into it. But anyway, I mean, that's a lot of money. I mean, even in banker terms, £17.8 million is not peanuts, and in political terms, it's quite a large amount of money.
Well,
possibly could have made the difference between major losing or winning the election, for example.
Well, certainly a fascinating twist to David Cameron's trip.
There's a further twist to the story, of course, which is that the warheads themselves then went missing. They lost them.
Well, how did they get the money for the £17 million then?
They went round Tory party donors and asked them to chip in to the pot, and then all of these people would then be paid back. And they were paid back. We've been given a list of people who actually made a lot of money. Makes my guns
Previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you've got a fast internet connection and you'd like to download a lot at once, you can try unwelcomeguests.net/downloads and download 100 episodes at a time. And if you're interested to explore the circumstances surrounding the death of David Kelly, I'd encourage you to do so at wikispooks.com. And if you broadcast this show, I would encourage you to join the low traffic mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. By unwelcome travelers, another brave man. They'll take the money and spread it out equal, just like the Bible and the prophets suggest. The men that go riding to help these poor workers. Which will cut down like an unwilling
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Ray McGovern, Russiagate. The Absence of Evidence, Part 2 of 2. Ray McGovern served as a CIA analyst for 27 years, from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. His duties included sharing national intelligence estimates and preparing the president's daily brief to Ronald Reagan's security advisers from 1981 to 1985. After retiring, he became a trusted source of information on the falsified intelligence about weapons of mass destruction that was used to bring the U.S. into the disastrous war in Iraq. He co-founded an organization of alumni from the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, the U.S. State Department's Intelligence Bureau, and the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA. They have the courage and expertise to analyze the so-called intelligence findings of the organizations they once served. Their name, VIPS, stands for Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and their members publish on up-to-date issues. Right after part one of this program, Ray McGovern, Russiagate, went out on January 8, 2019. There was a renewed effort by the New York Times and MSNBC to claim that Russian intelligence, or even Putin himself, intervened in the 2016 election. As this info spread through most of the media, TUC Radio got a little bit of a taste of kickback from Hillary supporters and people who so much want Trump to be gone that they don't feel like scrutinizing the evidence. The famous linguist, political analyst, and author Noam Chomsky is among the few who have investigated Russiagate. Here's a short clip from an interview by the Arizona blogger Primo Nutmeg, published on July 28, 2018.
I presume that Russia had an interest in the outcome of the election and probably tried to influence it. I don't consider that a major issue. For one thing, if you want to consider interventions in the elections, there are vastly greater ones. So, for example, it's well established by very solid empirical work by academic political scientists. Thomas Ferguson is the major one, that American elections are, in a certain sense, bought, in the sense that you can predict the outcome of an election with extreme precision simply by looking at the single variable of campaign funding. And in fact, Ferguson did a very close, careful analysis of the 2016 election, which verified this hypothesis in a way that most people aren't aware of. He looked closely at the way campaign funding worked, and it turned out in the last stages of the campaign, when the big investors and capitalist interests were beginning to be afraid that they didn't like Trump, but they were afraid that there might be a moderately liberal Democrat. They poured money in a very targeted way, not just to the president's, but to the Senate and House elections, and that led to a change which is reflected in the vote. That's real manipulation of elections, mm-hmm. massive manipulation, if the Russians did something minor, maybe. Furthermore, manipulation of elections by external powers is pretty normal. The United States, in fact, is the champion in that regard. We not only intervene in elections, we overthrow governments if we don't like them. In fact, if you want to look at manipulation of elections recently, the most striking example, which to my knowledge has only been reported in the business press, Bloomberg Business Week, is the last German elections. Everyone was surprised by the rise in votes gained by the more or less neo-fascist party, Alternative for Deutschland. Turns out that there was a campaign organized by a Texas media company that works for Trump, Le Pen, Netanyahu, others. They collaborated with the Berlin Facebook office, which provided them with a detailed demographic analysis of voters in Germany, and they were able to micro-target election-based ads to these individuals in a way which seems to have had a fairly significant influence on the rise of the neo-fascist party. Mm-hmm. That's a detectable case. In fact, the U.S. not only intervenes, but in elections, let's say in Russia, for example, but is very proud of it. So Clinton massively intervened in the, I think it was 1996 elections, in which Yeltsin, his favorite, was elected, and it was considered a great triumph. It wasn't hidden. So maybe the Russians tried to do something. There's no indication that it had much effect, but doesn't seem to me a significant issue. I think it's picked up by the Democrats and by the liberal press, because they hate Trump, of course, mm-hmm. and Democrats are seeking an excuse for why they lost an election, which should have been an open-shut affair if they'd had ran a decent campaign and had decent programs.
That was the iconic linguist, author, and political commentator Noam Chomsky. The full interview is on YouTube under the title Noam Chomsky on Russiagate. An important point made by Ray McGovern in part one of this program is his linguistic analysis of the, in his opinion, misnamed intelligence community assessment. He said in part one,
President Obama, in his last few weeks in office, this is 17 now, 2017, he was briefed by NSA, CIA, and the FBI that had done this very poor excuse for an intelligence assessment, adducing no real evidence, but saying that Putin himself had ordered the hacking of the DNC. Now, what's really interesting is that this document that everybody crows about, this intelligence community assessment, the only accurate word in those three words is assessment. Was it the intelligence community? No. Was it just three agencies of the intelligence community? No. What was it? It was hand-picked analysts from these three agencies, not the agencies themselves, hand-picked analysts. Who picked them? Who picked them? James Comey, for God's sake. Now, everyone knows in Washington that if you hand-pick the analysts, you hand-pick the conclusions, right? Okay. So there you had this document out that everyone is still crowing about. How can Trump stand next to Putin and not believe U.S. intelligence? You know, this is terrible, you know. Oh, U.S. intelligence is always correct, except for before Iraq and except for a couple other things, all right? So this is necessary because on the 18th, so we're talking about the 5th of January, 2017, Obama's briefed on all this, okay? Now, on the 18th, Obama gets up for his last press conference. And having read this and been briefed on this assessment that Putin himself directed that the DNC be hacked and the results be given to WikiLeaks, what does Obama say? He says, and I quote, "The conclusions of the intelligence community with respect to how Russian hacking got to WikiLeaks are inconclusive," period, end quote. Inconclusive conclusions. Wow. So why does Obama say that 2 days before he's going out of office? Because he's a lawyer. He wants to protect his dear derriere, you know?
That was Ray McGovern. Now you are about to hear arguments and evidence for lawbreaking of senior officials in intelligence organizations, such as the FBI and the Obama-era Department of Justice. McGovern states that instead of Russiagate, we ought to be talking about FBI-gate. Here's Ray McGovern, recorded on August 4, 2018, at the Common Good Cafe in Seattle, Washington. Thanks to Mike McCormick of KODXLP for the recording. Since August 2018, the roles of two people mentioned by McGovern have changed. Republican Devin Nunes was chair of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, a position that is now held by Democrat Adam Schiff. And you will hear from both of them.
I want to tell you that there are great advantages to live near Washington, and we've been there 55 years now. One advantage is that you get to go to meetings. You can even go to Hillary's and Podesta's old think tank, Center for American Progress or something like that. Okay, so that's what I do. I always go to those things, and if I can, if they'll recognize me, I raise my hand and ask a question. Well, we have queued up here a two-minute thing where I had already worn out my welcome the previous week, and so they wouldn't recognize me when I raised my hand. So I went up after Adam Schiff, Representative from California, who is the lead on all this Russiagate, and I didn't know the camera was on, and I just sort of asked him a question, and the whole deal was he told me, well, he couldn't tell me the answer because it was classified, okay? And it's pretty telling. I was delighted to learn later that day that C-SPAN cameras were still on. They even got the voice to it. So let's see if it works.
Chief, my name is Ray McGovern. I served in CIA under 7 presidents and 9 directors.
Well, thank you very much.
We have a little alumni group called Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. One of our members is the former technical director of NSA. I'm interested in 1 week ago when the president said this. I don't want to misquote him. The conclusions of the intelligence community with respect to Russian hacking were not conclusive regarding WikiLeaks. In other words, there's a big gap between alleged Russian hacking and WikiLeaks. The intelligence community does not know how or if that information, to the degree it exists, got to WikiLeaks. Now, you assert as flat fact that Russia did this. Do you know more than Obama?
Well, I would never claim to know more than Obama. I think he's a brilliant man.
It's a very serious question.
No, it's a serious question. I have every confidence in the intelligence of the Russian hacking of both the DNC as well as John Podesta.
James Clapper is a convicted.
You asked me a question. Do you want to hear the answer?
I will.
While I can't go into the classified information, I have every confidence that the Russians abused WikiLeaks. Whether Julian Assange was a knowing participant or, as the Russians would describe, a useful idiot, that we will hopefully find out, but I don't have any question in the conclusions that the intelligence...
You have every confidence, but no evidence. Is that right?
No, I can't share the evidence with you.
Yeah.
Congressman?
I'm
Paul
Joy, bogus.
I'm former
that's bogus.
Director of Security Center Intelligence.
So he has every confidence, but no evidence, yeah. It's so nice to know that these politicians have 100% confidence in the intelligence community. I mean, I feel so safe. Now, I think while this is still working, I'm going to show you one other short clip. Just to introduce it, there's one congressman. His name is Devin Nunes. He comes from the Central Valley of California. Now, I have to tell you that I know something about him because I met him about 9 or 10 years ago. He was the only congressperson, the only U.S. official that had the guts to give an award to one of the survivors of the USS Liberty. Now, I never thought that he'd reappear in this incarnation, the Intelligence Committee in the House, and seemed to be doing a job that is quite uncommon in Washington. See, the oversight committees have the idea that oversight is oversight, not oversight. So what Nunes is doing is holding people's feet to the fire. He had one interview with Cheryl Atkinson, who's a very good reporter, and I'm sure, you know, they rehearsed it. You ask me if these folks are guilty, these folks who thought Hillary was going to win and took great liberties with the law, ask me if they should be put on trial. Oh, wow. Now, I have never seen any House Committee chairman, Intelligence Committee chairman, say that, you know, anybody who lied or did this kind of subterranean thing should be put on trial. This is February 18th of 2018, and she asks him the question.
FBI on trial and to put Special Counsel Bob Mueller's investigation on trial.
Yeah, well, FISA abuse has nothing to do with the Mueller investigation. As it relates to Department of Justice and the FBI, if they need to be put on trial, we will put them on trial. The reason that Congress exists is to oversee these agencies that we created. DOJ and FBI are not above the law. Congress created them, we oversee them, and we fund them. And if they're committing abuse for a secret court, getting warrants on American citizens, you're darn right that we're going to put them on trial.
Okay, I'm going to be quick in finishing up here. In December of 2017, Russiagate migrated into FBI Gate. The people that Nunes is referring to here are the heads of the FBI, the CIA, the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, a couple of her deputies, all of whom signed these FISA warrants based on information paid for by Hillary Clinton, and now we know also paid for by the FBI. My God. So, that's how serious it is. Well, how many people know about the Lisa Page, Peter Strzok text message exchanges? Oh, wow. Okay. Well, okay, so you need to know where to get information about these things. Okay, long story short, Peter Strzok and his paramour, Lisa Page. Peter Strzok was the second highest counterintelligence official in the FBI, and Lisa Page was a very highly paid attorney working for the deputy director of the FBI, McCabe. And they had this affair going where they exchanged several hundred messages a day. It's amazing, okay? And early on, Peter Strzok at one point says, Hillary should win 1 million to nothing, right? And Lisa says, yes, she should win 1 million to nothing. Next one, he says, congratulations on a woman running for president. High time. And she says, oh, that's so cute. These are direct things, okay? Now, she says early on, now, Peter, we feel free to share our views about Trump and so forth. And our support for Hillary, because this can't be collected, right? This is secure, these FBI phones. And he said, oh, no problem. Yeah, you're right. Okay. Here's the deputy head of counterintelligence of the FBI doesn't realize that the NSA and everybody else can easily collect stuff from a bureau phone, right? Okay. So that's how it went. Now, what happened was, and this is really interesting, because the Inspector General of the Justice Department, which has purview over the FBI as well, the Inspector General does, have found these messages as a result of the Mueller investigation and all this kind of stuff, and they came out in the open December 2017. We had them, all the things I just mentioned. But they didn't share these messages. Well, Lisa Page says, he's not going to win, is he? He's not going to win. And Peter says, no, he'll never win. We will stop it. Quote, we will stop it. The last thing I'll mention from this exchange is that After he supervised the investigation of Hillary Clinton and her emails, he was asked to join Mueller's operation and did join Mueller's operation. But in that interim period, he's talking with Lisa, and Lisa says, are you gonna join the Mueller operation to get to the bottom of Russiagate? And he says, yeah, I don't want to. I mean, there's no there there. How many of you know that Peter Strzok said that? Three. You guys read the New York Times or the Seattle Times. You didn't know that Peter Strzok said that there's no there there? You got to read RayMcGovern.com. If you don't get it, you don't get it. Now, ConsortiumNews.com is another really, really good website that only three or four people knew about Peter Strzok saying there's no there there. That's the message, folks. He knew. He had looked into all this stuff by this time, and he knew that there was no there there. Wow. Well, let me finish up here. These telltale signs, the ostensible hack, which had this metadata attached to it, and had the Cyrillic, and had the name of the name and patronymic of Felix Emunovich, the first head of the Cheka, they called in those days, the KGB forerunner. Who else might have done that? Well, you know why they hate Julian Assange? Because you wouldn't know this if you read the New York Times, but on the 31st of March, he released documentation, authentic CIA memos and emails showing that CIA had developed a cyber tool which allows the new CIA directorate. Now, when I say directorate, that means several thousand people, okay? There were only three directorates when I was there. Now there are four. Cyber warfare is the fourth, okay? Which allows the CIA to hack into a system or a computer or a server, disguise who hacked in, and leave telltale signs giving the responsibility to somebody else. Whoa. Immediately, the New York Times, as its wont these days, contacted the CIA or the White House, said, should we publish that? No, don't publish that. Unfortunately, or fortunately, Ellen Nakashima from the Washington Post didn't get the memo. She didn't get the memo, so she published a really good story, CIA secret capabilities to hack in, disclosed, okay? And she showed in her article that they work in five languages, right? Chinese, Korean, Persian, Arabic, and Russian. Cyrillic, okay? And she didn't indicate this, but the original information, which nobody disputes, this is direct from the CIA, okay, that it was used during 2016. Now, we make a real sharp distinction here, Bill Binney and I. What we said about forensics is science, right? It's physics, okay? We can prove it. Now, we can't prove that it was John Brennan. We can't prove that it was the CIA cyber hackers that hacked in and left these telltale signs, but we think it's a likely possibility, okay? And that's why you have them coming after Julian Assange full bore. 2 weeks after that revelation, Pompeo got up and he said, Julian Assange is a demon. I didn't used to believe in demons, you know, but he believes in demons, apparently. He's a demon, and he's running a non-state hostile intelligence service. Now, you know that Julian Assange has been held incommunicado since the late March. He's in bad health. They're out to get him. And they're out to get him because he has this way of getting authentic CIA documents. Again, nobody disputes the authenticity of this. Nobody knows about it, really, judging from the few people who knew about what they call Vault 7. It's marble framework. That's what they call this particular tool. So, you know, it's really pretty bad, because what we have now is the deep state. And I use the term advisedly. There is a deep state. And when you look at the FBI, you look at the CIA, to a lesser extent the NSA, you look now at the Justice Department. They have a lot to protect themselves against, because they thought Hillary's going to win. Comey has said that. And that explains, pure and simple, why they thought they could take extracurricular, extra legal measures to make sure she won and to make sure Trump lost, and after the election, to use this information to the degree they could to blacken Trump so he can't reach out to Russia. And that's another story. A lot of people think it makes good sense to have a decent relationship with Russia, but not what Pope Francis called the blood-soaked arms traders, okay? And that's a big, big lobby. What we have now is what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. What we have now is the military-industrial congressional intelligence media complex. It all fits together, folks. And we don't know half of what's going on. Not even you, who are progressive and keep up on these things. Most of you didn't know about Marble Framework and the likelihood, as Bill Binney and I see it, there was a CIA that hacked in on the 5th of July, 2016, and left these telltale signs. So it's pretty serious. Now, the question really, and I'll finish with this, is you saw Devin Nunes. He threw down the gauntlet, didn't he? He said, if they're guilty, they're going to go to trial. Whoa! This is big! Loretta Lynch going to jail? James Comey? Liar that he is? Bob Mueller? John Brennan? So what I'd like to just leave with you is the thought that unless we know about what's going on, these guys are going to prevail. They always do. So to the degree you become informed a little bit better and you find out what Nunes is really after to get to the bottom of this, and the Democrats are trying to, I think in a quixotic way, trying to make a big deal out of this, because last thing I'll say, very last thing, is in the little brochure, I indicated what is taking Bob Mueller so long? And the answer is, because there's no there there. Thank you very much.
You heard the conclusion of a two-part program with Ray McGovern on debunking Russiagate. He was recorded by Mac McCormick for KODXLP on August 4, 2018. At the Common Good Cafe in Seattle, Washington. KODX posted the talk on YouTube, and you can see the one-hour film there and add to the over 120,000 views the film had already received by the time of this recording in early January 2019. And that includes more information that did not fit into the TUC radio airtime. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The waste footprint from that is actually pretty massive, just so you can have a little clamshell to carry your strawberries home in. And how long do you use that?
The average U.S. resident heads out to the grocery store 1.5 times a week, and over the course of a year, uses well over 1,000 plastic shopping bags there. Bags which, on average, are used for a mere 15 minutes, but will stick around on the earth for hundreds of years. This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Catherine Holmesy, is fed up with the status quo and has changed her food shopping habits to better reflect her values. She gives us insight into the plastic habit of food retailers, talks about what to do about it, and tells us of her particular annoyance with Trader Joe's, the popular grocer that was once her favorite. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my friend Catherine Holmesy. She is an organizational consultant with a focus on reducing waste. Catherine, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
So why don't you first talk about some of the work you do in terms of decluttering people's lives with a focus on sustainability?
Sure. I started doing organizing consultancy just out of my interest in zero waste a few years back. Bea Johnson, the mother of the zero waste movement, became really well known for her website and a book called Zero Waste Home. She took a concept that was previously used in industry, which basically meant a closed loop manufacturing cycle with no waste, kind of a cradle to cradle concept, and she took it into the home and began to develop ways to reduce waste and consumption to the point that her family of four only produced a quart of garbage a year. And I thought, I was doing a really good job. I recycled, quote unquote, everything, just like you should. I separated my recycling. I put my compost in the compost. I didn't buy something if it didn't have that little recycling arrow on it.
But of course, that quart of waste that she would be producing a year is also a tip of the cap to the local waste management facilities or the organization that's in place in terms of waste management. There's a lot of cities that wouldn't allow curbside recycling or composting, right?
That's true. We're really fortunate in San Francisco to have a Recology following San Francisco's goal of zero waste and doing everything to facilitate our moving in that direction. That being said, there's no way to do it by recycling alone. There's absolutely no way. There's all this plastic, all these containers, they are not really recyclable. And that's something I learned after learning more about zero waste. You can put everything in that recycling bin, but plastic is so contaminated with chemicals, with being melted down with other things that aren't the same type of plastic. It becomes so very contaminated. At most, it can be recycled maybe four or so times. After that, it's really not recyclable. And what happens is either it goes into the landfill or it can be upcycled or, you know, made into a park bench or something that, when that is finished with its life, will be thrown into the landfill. So after learning that what I thought was a wonderful system that I was so lucky to plug into, allowing me to, quote unquote, recycle everything, that everything wasn't actually recyclable, the zero waste movement taught me that the only thing to do, if I really cared about reducing waste and this waste problem that we are seeing more and more, is to reduce consumption.
Yes, and still, a quart, no matter how good your waste management system is, a quart a year is pretty heroic.
That's not typical. My family is not there yet, despite our best efforts. We're not at that level. That
takes some serious vigilance, huh?
Absolutely, and she used that to show what was possible. I would say that's, you know, definitely the pie in the sky gold standard. It's possible. It's doable. If you have access to a good system, if you have access to good grocery options where you can buy things unpackaged, where you can go to farmers markets, where you have the time and money to be able to seek these options out, where you can have a good secondhand market where you want to buy clothes instead of buying them new, where you have a good secondhand market for really anything. If you aren't in an area with those, yeah, it's going to be much harder.
If you can invest in longer term solutions like a nice cloth bag, you go to the developing world, you'll see everybody has those little plastic vinyl bags, right? Mm-hmm. It's just standard. Mm-hmm. People haven't necessarily spent the dollar or two to get these permanent bags when they can get these for free.
Right. And I absolutely recognize that, you know, for example, let's take the famous glass jars that everybody uses. You can reuse a glass jar that you get from the grocery store, and there's no problem with that. There are a lot of people who decide they want it to be perfect and have all the matching jars with the clasp lids that are like $6 or $7 a jar. And that's lovely and all, but that's not doable for most people to have a huge collection of these beautiful matching jars. And it's not necessary either. But I think regardless of your means or your access, if you have the knowledge that this is a problem, there are little things that you can do. You can use things over and over again instead of using them once and throwing them out. You can make small choices if it doesn't impact you financially too badly, like choosing something in a glass jar rather than in a plastic container. You can use reusable grocery shopping bags, or you can use your paper or plastic ones over and over until they're not usable anymore. There are things everyone can do. There is that gold standard of a quart of garbage a year, but that's not the baseline.
And you mentioned how plastic waste, just because it's out of sight and out of mind, doesn't necessarily mean it's out of our waste stream.
Right.
So you've been a thorn in the side to one of the more popular grocery chains in America, Trader Joe's, which has a pretty sterling reputation in terms of the way it treats its employees and the quality of their food. But why don't you explain your problem with Trader Joe's? I hadn't really thought of it, and I'm glad to have this conversation with you.
Well, first of all, I did used to go to Trader Joe's every week. It was part of my routine. I'd stop by Trader Joe's. The kids would search around the store for the alligator to see if they could win a lollipop. It's a good grocery store. They have good quality food. They have a good selection of organic products, of natural products, without a lot of preservatives and additives. So they're a pretty good option if you want to strive for a healthier version of a grocery store. So I used to go once a week. I took the kids. We would do our shopping. And I always was a little bummed about the produce situation. Even when I was shopping there weekly, I couldn't buy salad, you know, out of the bin, buy a whole head of lettuce. I had to buy a bag of salad. And even before I really was an anti-plastic crusader, if you will, I didn't like that. I didn't really like that. That felt so wasteful to me, having a stack of plastic bags if I wanted a large amount of salad, for example, or not being able to pick out which apples I want or which avocados I wanted. They were all bagged together, and usually about half of them weren't really great. But, you know, you get what you get. You grab the bag of them, and there you are. So I shopped there regardless, but I collected all my plastic bags, and I returned them to the store for recycling. I put all the clamshell packages in the bin. And then I learned how really poorly recyclable plastic is and how hard it is to recycle it and how most of it really doesn't get recycled regardless of which bin you put it in. So that is when I started buying fewer things at Trader Joe's and searching for more options. And then I basically, over the course of a month or so, weaned myself completely off of Trader Joe's, found other options elsewhere, and never went back again.
So let's break down the pros and cons of why
Trader Joe's uses a lot of plastic in their produce and a lot, all their products, really. First of all, are there some stores that are doing it better that you can identify? Big chains.
Big chains. There are some stores that are doing it better, although it's a problem at every store. But there are some stores where it's easier to avoid. Whole Foods still is got a good selection of produce that you can choose. You know, they have a big selection of apples, and you can put them straight into your cart or put them in your own bag or however you choose to buy them.
Yes, that's the problem. Like, Trader Joe's will have a decent amount of loose produce out there, but then there's things that you wouldn't expect that needed to be in plastic, like broccoli and zucchini and carrots. Things that are that last pretty well without plastic are in clamshells or bags and film. Have you contacted the store to try to find out why they do this?
I've looked into it a bit. I haven't emailed back and forth with them. I did, way back when, send them an email to let them know that I was sorry to say I wasn't going to shop there anymore because of the packaging. If they decided to change that, I'd be happy to come back.
That wasn't enough to make them change.
No, strangely, shockingly, they didn't change because of me.
But if there are enough people out there, I mean, you have friends at the Plastic Pollution Coalition who are organized a little bit more to try to make changes within an organization like Trader Joe's, right?
Absolutely. And that's actually what it comes down to, is everyone says, oh, it doesn't matter what I do personally on a personal level. It won't make a difference. Well, sure, said 7 billion people. When you add it up, it does make a difference. If enough people stop shopping and buying that way, we vote with our dollar. That's the strongest vote we have sometimes, is our dollar. We can decide to participate in that or we can't. And again, I will say there are people who don't have access to different stores by virtue of like where they live or their budget or whatever. But the people who do have the access and the knowledge can make that decision.
Is it more effective to stop shopping there or to keep shopping and to actively engage your favorite store and the people who work there every time you go there?
I don't think the people who work there have that much power in the packaging because that's all done centrally. But you're still buying it, is the thing. So you're still buying that clamshell full of zucchini and they're still making money off of it. So where's their motivation to stop if you are still buying it?
And have you gotten a response from Trader Joe's or what are their public statements regarding their use of all of this plastic?
So they say on their website that it keeps it sanitary. It makes it easier to ship because it's in packaging. So it basically makes it easier to pack to ship. It makes it easier to transport and it makes it easier to put it on the shelves when you're grabbing, let's say, a bag full of apples and putting it there rather than stacking the apples nicely so they don't fall, I suppose.
And that's one of the arguments of the bottled water industry, is like, we use plastic bottles rather than glass because it saves us X amount in shipping costs and our carbon footprint is X amount lower because of we're saving fuel on moving all of our bottles around in plastic form rather than in glass. They may not brag about that, but that must be one of the reasons that they have for putting so many products in plastic.
It's lightweight and it's super cheap. Plastic is really, really inexpensive. But that's because we're not paying the real cost of plastic yet. We're not paying for that. We're paying the cost of oil because plastic is made from oil. So we're paying the cost of plastic and the cost that it is to produce it. We're not paying for the life cycle of it, but people are going to pay for that one way or another, whether it comes to pollution and the poorer countries and people in poorer areas pay that price much sooner than people in more wealthy areas. We don't walk out to the river and see a sea of plastic in the river. But in poor areas, they do see that.
And I would imagine that's one of the talking points that a Trader Joe's might have over a Whole Foods, because Whole Foods is not targeting a demographic that is as cost conscious as Trader Joe's customers. And they say, we are able to offer our customers the lowest prices and the highest quality because we've taken into account the plastic thing, but we think it's worth it because there are people who can afford to buy our products now. You know, people who wouldn't necessarily be able to buy arugula can now buy it.
Because we're keeping the costs down. Well, they do talk a bit about that, a little tiny, I think, about that. I do personally, and this is not based on anything I've read on their website, but if you look at the food waste that grocery stores go through when people pick and choose the best things and leave the things that aren't so great behind, well, you don't have that at Trader Joe's. You buy the bag of apples, you buy the bag of avocados, you buy the container of strawberries.
More than you might want to buy.
More than you might want to buy. And I unfortunately did many, many times have the experience that I would buy the bag of avocados, for example, and two of them would be good and two or three of them would be bad. So they didn't have to throw away that avocado and lose that. I still paid for the avocado. I still took it home. I still ended up throwing away the avocado. So while it saves them the cost of that food waste of me rejecting the bad avocado, that food is still wasted.
Right. That's the important thing. So they can say, well, we've reduced our food waste by 45%, but that food still may be getting wasted if a consumer is throwing it away. On the flip side, you have a bigger chain like a Safeway that also is trying to reduce food waste. They have a different calculus in how they fill their produce bins and how they perceive waste. Maybe you can contrast that and which method do you think is less wasteful ultimately? Doesn't have to be Safeway specifically, but the flip side of what Trader Joe's is
okay.
doing.
Well, I did used to work at the food bank for a number of years doing fundraising, and companies like Safeway and Whole Foods did participate in a program where they donated the produce that was almost on the way out or it was a little past to the food bank, and the food bank would go around and pick it up. So that reduced the food waste in that the food that was still edible, we would donate to our clients, and the food that was not edible went to a pig farm actually. So that's one way to reduce the food waste, and they get to write it off as a donation.
Anybody who has a pet who's asked a butcher for scraps or things like that, I've noticed that the Safeways and the Trader Joe's of the world do not just give those away like they used to 20 years ago. They have a supply chain for it.
Interesting. I didn't know that. But I've also learned that there are grocery stores who won't release that stuff because of liability purposes too. So they're afraid that they'll get sued if you take their day old whatever or their scrap whatever and get sick from it. I don't know how much you've seen about the food waste issue, but there are some interesting documentaries about people who buy no food at all, who dumpster dive behind grocery stores and save lots and lots of food, but these grocery stores have security guards to keep them from doing it. They'll lock the dumpsters. They don't want people to eat the food, and often the food isn't even expired yet.
Yes, we had, I forget his name, but we had an author who did a piece on food waste, and he was talking about doing that for a month or two, eating dumpster dived food. I don't know the correct grammar there, but he noted that America wastes enough food to fill up the Rose Bowl every day.
It's pretty shocking. Yeah. And a lot of that is because all these, this food, this processed food, you know, it's subsidized and it's cheap and it's almost disposable. You know, I'm not necessarily advocating for food to be more expensive because for some people it's already too expensive. But that being said, we don't really value our food. We buy a bunch of food, and at the end of the week, if we haven't eaten it, too many people just throw it away. Mm-hmm. We don't do our best to try to use it because we don't pay for it in a way that makes it seem like it's a valuable commodity.
Give me your funny. never give you my number. I only give you my situation. And in the middle of investigation, I break down.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm talking to Catherine Holmesy. She's an organizational consultant who focuses on reducing waste. So, Catherine, getting back to the traditional model that a Safeway or a Kroger might have versus the Trader Joe's model. So Trader Joe's might say, well, you know, at least we're not throwing away as much produce as the Safeways of the world. But Safeway might have deeper pockets or better supply chains to be able to handle that waste, as opposed to Trader Joe's, which we think, just without having data, that they're actually passing a lot of that waste on to consumers.
That was my personal experience shopping at Trader Joe's, that I ended up throwing away too much produce because what part of what came in the bag or the clamshell had gone bad already.
I find that I often let it go bad because I buy more than I actually need.
Because we buy more than we need. Yeah, that's a problem I think all of us run into sometimes.
And these hypermarkets like the Costco's that sell these massive amounts. Yeah. If you're a family of three or four, good luck trying to use all the food that you end up buying because it seems like a good deal.
Well, exactly. Yeah, it's not really a good deal if you end up throwing half of it away, is it?
And then the plastic waste.
Yeah.
So you're actually not only wasting the food, you're also using plastic that was unnecessary to begin with.
Exactly. So the plastic's unnecessary. It's cheap. We don't pay the full price of it. And by the way, the full price of plastic is also not just the disposal end.
The externalities of it are massive.
Producing it, drilling for the oil. You know, the oil spills that come out of that, the manufacturing of it, the pollution from the manufacturing, the water pollution, the air pollution, the waste that comes from that manufacturing. And then you get the plastic product. It's packaged in one place. It's shipped all over the place to these distributors. So you have the shipping waste and pollution that comes from that. But the waste footprint from that is actually pretty massive, just so you can have a little clamshell to carry your strawberries home in. And how long do you use that? I think what was the number of minutes that a plastic bag is used is about 15 minutes before it's thrown away. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a pretty massive amount of waste for 15 minutes of use carrying something from the store to your home.
Yes. And all those clamshell things are essentially single-use plastic, too. We don't think of them because they look more permanent.
They're absolutely single-use. Their purpose is to encase a product, get it to your home, and then be thrown away. So it's on us. We have to stop producing it is what it comes down to. And we have gotten into this habit that we go to the grocery store and we want to buy some grapes and we expect them to provide us something to carry those grapes home in, and they will give us the cheapest thing that we can use, and that's plastic.
We also expect them to be perfect, right? Yes. And we expect to get red seedless grapes in January in
yes.
Minnesota. So there's right. also the bar has risen in terms of consumer demands and expectations.
Yeah, that is a vicious cycle, isn't it? It's that expectation has been set by the industry, if you will, and we have bought into it, and now we absolutely expect it. When you go to a hotel breakfast in January and you get cantaloupe, you know, honeydew melon and strawberries and blueberries, those are middle of summer fruit. And they have no flavor, by the way, in January, but you still get a plate of them because that's what they have been trained that we expect, and that's what they're going to give us, and regardless of the quality and regardless of whether it's appropriate.
I remember being in the early 90s in Japan, being miffed that some of my favorite foods were only seasonal. My first few months there, I was really in love with these, the steamed buns, and they'd have mead and sweet bean paste and all these other ones in them. And then mid-March came around, all those little steam ovens that were by the cashier had disappeared, and I found out that this was just a winter food. And I was like, what's a winter food? I was apoplectic over this. This was my favorite little snack. And the Japanese actually apply that to almost everything with their cuisine, whether it be regional or seasonal, they like to kind of, it gives more value to these udon noodles, which are famous in Nagano in the winter, or these cold soba noodles, which are representative of Kansai in the summer, whatever. Mm-hmm. So if we can find the beauty in that seasonality again, that would be really great.
I'm all for it. Like right now is just the closing end of persimmon season here in California, right? So as soon as I watch the stores starting in fall for the persimmons, as soon as they come in, I buy as much as I can eat, and I eat at least one a day during the season, and I'm noticing they're changing the quality. The skins are getting thicker and they're getting softer. So I know the season's about to end. But you know what? I appreciate every single day of that persimmon season because I know it won't come again until next year. And I think, yeah, it'd be great to have persimmons all the time, but maybe they wouldn't be as special that way. And maybe we can get back to thinking that way.
So beyond just bringing your own bags and making some smarter decisions about where you shop, maybe you can give some inside hints to listeners who are interested in making a more positive impact for 2019.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of being a smarter food shopper.
A smarter food shopper. Definitely bring your own grocery bags. Make sure that you keep grocery, if wherever you're going to remember it, whether it's in the trunk of your car, whether it's on your door handle before you leave the house, or a little pouch in your office desk. Just make sure you have a reusable bag available that you can use so you don't have to scramble for it. Buy more produce that's unpackaged. And when you buy it unpackaged, don't put it in a plastic bag if it doesn't really need it. You know, if it's not going to get damaged, there's no reason to put it in a bag. It's absolutely not necessary. Consider bringing your own produce bags if you're up for that. You can reuse old plastic bags as many times as you can, your old produce bags. I buy fabric bags. So you can bring your own produce bags as well as shopping bags. Think about your choice for a minute and don't be afraid to go without something if you feel like it's a bad choice. If you see something that then there's an option to buy it in glass, get it in glass instead of plastic. If there aren't any options that look good, if all the grapes are in a clamshell, maybe just don't get grapes that time. Get something else. Get something unpackaged. Be willing to be flexible about what you're buying. And seek out those stores that are in your area that really support buying in bulk. So just look, be creative and look at the resources that are already out there. Zero Waste Home website is amazing. Plastic Free Life is amazing. Those are both local people who are pioneers in the area. Be open to different ideas and just be conscious of it.
Catherine Holmesy, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much, Alex. It was good to be here.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Stevie Wonder and the Beatles. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.